This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. And every other fifth Wednesday, I want to open the phones to get your takes on the world. And now on to today's program. You rarely hear or read much about the war in Yemen these days, but as violence there continues to escalate, there are warnings by international aid agencies of a new cholera outbreak in the port city of Hodeidah, which is currently under a Saudi Arabia-United Arab Emirate blockade, backed to the fullest extent by the United States military. The Saudi and UAE jets that have been bombing Yemen since 2015 were purchased from the United States, but that wasn't the end of it. Their mid-air refueling, like their target selection, first authorized by President Obama, has been coordinated with U.S. military intelligence, ostensibly, we have been told, to reduce the number of civilian casualties, which, unlike the war in Syria, the media appears to have stopped counting when the number of dead was estimated to have reached 10,000. As new air attacks are launched on the city held by Yemeni Houthis, mistakenly characterized by the U.S. media as rebels, the aid organizations and human rights groups are worried about the fighting will turn what the U.N. has declared to be the world's worst humanitarian crisis into a far greater catastrophe. They warn of a second cholera epidemic and that more than 8 million Yemeni civilians starvation. I'll be speaking on this subject at 20 minutes past the hour with renowned human rights activist Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and a recent article calling attention to America's ongoing support for the Saudi-UAE war crimes in Yemen. I have two more items on Yemen before moving on to related subjects. I mentioned earlier how the estimated numbers of dead in Yemen have stalled at 10,000. Last week, writing in the Washington Post from his base in Istanbul, Karim Fahim observed, quote, "There is no end in sight to the vicious war in Yemen, to the blood-soaked battles or careless airstrikes or waves of hunger and disease that stalk civilians even if they escape the bullets and the bombs. And yet the death toll seems to stand still. For 2 years," he writes, "a figure, 10,000 people, has been frequently cited by journalists and relief agencies to describe the number of civilians' deaths in the conflict. The number was based largely on reports from Yemen's crippled health network and first mentioned by a senior United Nations official in August 2016, 2 years ago. But in public discussion of the conflict," he notes, "the number has never been revised, even as the war has retained its ruthless intensity. It is almost certainly conservative and possibly grossly underestimated, according to UN officials and a now analyst who studied the conflict," writes Fahim, "with one independent estimate putting the total number of Yemenis killed in combat at nearly 50,000, end quote. Fahim suggests the nature of the fighting makes it difficult for both journalists and aid organizations to make estimates of the dead. This is no doubt true, but there is also, I suspect, another reason. It is that the United States government and the mainstream media have invariably follows Washington's agenda, believe that by keeping the death tolls low, the American public will ignore the war and the critical role that the United States has played in it, dating from President Obama's time in office. In Syria, we see the opposite. An escalation of the number of deaths, now estimated to be at 500,000, for which there is no independent confirmation apart from an outfit called the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. No doubt most of you have heard of it. What you probably don't know is that the so-called observatory consists of just one man sitting presumably with computers and cell phones in the town of Coventry in the British Midlands, where he runs a clothing shop. That man, Osama Suleiman, under the name Rami Abdulrahman, claims to have been imprisoned 3 times for his activism against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Understandably, he has sided with the Syrian opposition since initiating his project back in 2006. In 2012, the German publication Süddeutsche Zeitung described the organization as a one-man operation with Osama its only permanent member. According to Media Lens, which monitors such things, Osama has received just under £200,000, roughly $260,000, to purchase cameras and communications equipment from the British Foreign Office, which also has been a major funder of the Syrian White Helmets, a number of whom had to be rescued by the Israelis and transported into Jordan 2 weeks ago to prevent them falling into Syrian government hands. On another critical Middle Eastern front, this past Monday saw the reimposition of harsh sanctions on Iran that had been lifted following Tehran's signing of the agreement with the U.S., U.K., France, China, Russia, and Germany to halt its nuclear enrichment program and the threat, quite openly by Washington, that the U.S. will once again apply secondary sanctions on any country or company that continues to do business with Iran. If President Trump is considered a bully by his domestic critics, consider they may simply be the reflection of how the U.S. treats the world, be it longstanding allies, with the exception of Israel, of course, or perceived enemies. Exemplifying this bullying attitude was a letter initiated by Texas Senator Ted Cruz and signed by nine fellow Republicans, among them Florida's Marco Rubio and Arkansas's Tom Cotton. They write, "We urge you to comply with all American sanctions, but also to emphasize we would consider it particularly troubling if you sought to evade or undermine American statutes," stated the senator's letter. First, they wrote, "These statutes align with your government's commitment to deepen cooperation addressing Iran's ballistic missile program and destabilizing activities. Second, they were passed over several years by overwhelming bipartisan majorities, including in some cases via unanimous Senate passage, and Congress is obligated to ensure their implementation. Any attempt to evade or undermine them," the letter warns, "could well prompt congressional action in coordination with other elements of the U.S. government to ensure their integrity," end quote. The remainder of the letter continues in the same vein and demonstrates the utter contempt of the American political class for its European counterparts. And I suspect the only reason no Democrat senators signed the letter is that none were asked. What it does make clear is that Europe must choose between the United States and Iran. Despite a series of meetings with senior Iranian officials to discuss tactics for evading new American sanctions, and despite a joint statement issued Monday by the foreign ministers of Britain, France, Germany, and the European Union to, quote, "protect European economic operators engaged in legitimate business with Iran," end quote, it seems inevitable that they will give in when the alternative is to lose access to the far greater U.S. economy. According to yesterday's New York Times, more than 100 businesses had already announced their intent to leave Iran ahead of the sanctions. The most critical blow for Iran from Monday's sanctions was the previously announced cancellation by Boeing of an unprecedented $16.6 billion deal to upgrade Iran's aged and tattered passenger airline that hasn't had a new plane since 1979 due to past U.S. sanctions. A full range of sanctions, including Iran's sales of crude oil, are slated to be put back in place by November 4th, with a range of new ones expected early this month. Among their targets will be the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, or SWIFT. You may not have heard of it, but it's a major provider of global financial services. America and Europe's SWIFT have reportedly been told that they, too, will not be spared from new sanctions if they continue to facilitate business with Iran. Quote, "There's no question the banks represented on the board of SWIFT are in serious jeopardy, both the American banks and the foreign ones," said Richard Goldberg, a senior advisor to the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a pro-Israel lobbying operation and successor to the Project for New American Century that curiously was founded on the day after 9/11. Goldberg, a former senior Senate aide, was one of the architects of the initial SWIFT sanctions on Iran in early 2012. "Congress authorized the president to take a wide range of actions," he says, "against directors personally and against their financial institution employers. The Trump administration understands how crucial it is to sever Iran from SWIFT," said Goldberg, "so you can bet they will seek maximum enforcement of the sanctions." End quote. Diplomatic warnings to SWIFT directors not to challenge the U.S. sanctions have reportedly already been issued. Such is the latest episode of the U.S. against the world. For most intents and purposes, the U.S. has declared war on Iran with the intent of overthrowing its government. Will any of those who have been complaining about Russia's alleged interference in U.S. politics acknowledge Washington's far greater transgressions against Iran? Not likely. By squeezing Iran's economy, Washington hopes to drive its citizenry into the streets, as has happened these past few days, protesting the collapsing economy and depreciation of the rial. Iran's currency thanks to these new sanctions. The U.S. is particularly interested in reaching those Iranians who supported President Rouhani, expecting economic benefits to flow following the lifting of sanctions after Iran signed the agreement halting Iran's nuclear enrichment program for at least a decade, which President Trump ripped apart. Those sanctions have been implemented due in a large part to the pressures by Israel lobby in the U.S., particularly AIPAC, and the sister organizations in Britain, France, and Germany. You've heard me on numerous occasions speaking of AIPAC's outsized and pernicious influence over Congress, but their French and British counterparts are no slouches when it comes to making demands of their respective parliaments. In Britain, each party has its own pro-Israel caucus. Thus, there is the Labour Friends of Israel, the Conservative Friends of Israel, and the Liberal Democrats Friends of Israel, and, as if that was not sufficient, there is the all-party Britain-Israel parliamentary group, which brings them all together, not for Britain, but for Israel. This should be considered quite extraordinary when one considers that among Britain's population of 65 million, there are less than 300,000 Jews, not all of whom are on the same page when it comes to Israel. That they represent at best 1/250th of the British population has not stopped the Jewish Board of Deputies from waging a nonstop campaign against Labour Party leader and its likely candidate for Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn, claiming he is surrounded by anti-Semites and is soft in anti-Semitism, with one British Jewish leader declaring that the election of Corbyn, a longtime supporter of Palestinian rights, would be, quote, an existential threat to the Jews of Britain, end quote. In an unsuccessful effort to defuse these attacks, Corbyn submitted to an interview that was more of an inquisition by a reporter for a London Jewish paper, A Third His Age. He purged alleged anti-Semites in the party and renounced his earlier support for a German Holocaust survivor who had compared Israel's treatment of the Palestinians to the Nazis' treatment of the Jews. The latest attack came last weekend when the Board of Deputies rejected a proposal by Corbyn to adopt 3 out of 4 internationally accepted definitions of anti-Semitism that had been omitted by the Labour Party's new guidelines on the issue last month. According to a report in the Jewish News, Corbyn is considering adopting 3 of the definitions following a massive backlash against him and the Labour Party from the British Jewish community, the British media, and Labour moderates. The 3 definitions of anti-Semitism that the party has accepted are, 1, the allegation that Jews are more loyal to Israel than their country of citizenship, comparisons of contemporary Israeli society to that of the Nazis, and applying double standards to Israeli policy and actions that are not expected of other countries. The 1 International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, definition that is reportedly not being considered for adoption by Labour is a claim that, quote, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, that is, by claiming that the existence of Israel is a racist, the state of Israel is a racist endeavor, end quote. In response to the report, the Board of Deputies issued a statement on Twitter saying that, quote, we won't accept a watered-down definition designed to let anti-Semites off the hook, and pointed out that the IHRA definitions specifically state that, quote, criticism of Israel similar to that leveled against any other country cannot be regarded as anti-Semitic, end quote. In a column by Corbyn published by The Guardian on Friday, the Labour Party leader specifically said the definition describing Israel as a racist endeavor being anti-Semitic is what bothered him. I acknowledge, he said, that most of the Jewish community, including many Labour supporters, take a different view. The community, he said, should have been consulted more extensively at an earlier stage, which is why our executive has decided last month to reopen the development of the code in consultation with Jewish community organizations and others to address their concerns, end quote. The closest Corbyn came to criticism of Israel was his noting that, quote, this has been a difficult year in the Middle East, with the killing of many unarmed Palestinian protesters in Gaza, and Israel's new nation-state law relegating Palestinian citizens of Israel to second-class status. I know, he wrote, that many within the Jewish community, including the Board of Deputies, share our concerns. End quote. Meanwhile, further allegations of anti-Semitism were made against Corbyn by the Daily Mail on Sunday, which or the Sunday Mail, which said that the labor leader referred to a Jewish member of parliament, Louise Elman, in private as, quote, the honorable member for Tel Aviv, end quote, ostensibly accusing her of representing Israel instead of her constituents in the House of Commons. A spokesman for Labor strongly denied the allegation. But the attacks on Corbyn are certain to continue up until the election. This has been Jeff Blankford, hoping you all stay safe. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we feature James Zugby, founder and president of the American Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based organization which serves as a political and policy research arm of the Arab American community. James Zugby was born in the United States of Palestinian parents and is an important Palestinian voice that needs to be heard. On May 22, 2018, he spoke to the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center, and it begins with his introduction by Director Mohammed Mohammed.
Hello, everybody. Thanks again for joining us here at the Jerusalem Fund. And as I always mention, if you could please silence your cell phones so we can avoid that awkward interruption. My name is Mohammed Mohammed. I'm the executive director here at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. And on behalf of our board of directors and staff, it's always a pleasure to have you here. And it's always a pleasure to have everybody online. So thank you all for joining us. It's also a great honor to introduce and welcome back our distinguished speaker today, Dr. James Zugby, who will be speaking about political Zionism and the roots of Palestinian dispossession. As most of you know, this year marks the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, which resulted in hundreds of thousands of Palestinians being forced to become stateless refugees, including my own grandparents. And they became refugees in exile, waiting to return to their homes, while many others were reduced to aliens in their own country, living under Israeli military rule. Although the Nakba produced a nightmare for the Palestinian people, it has largely been ignored in the West. Palestinians have been victims, but in the U.S. they have been invisible victims. When Palestinians are considered at all, they are referred to as the Palestinian problem, confronting Israel, and the problem that must somehow be resolved so that Israelis can have peace. In this talk, Dr. Zugby will review the ideology and practice of the movement of political Zionism and its patron, British imperialism, that together were responsible for the denial of Palestinian rights and the subsequent campaigns of disinformation and the repression against the Palestinian people. His updated book, I believe he wrote this book many, many years ago, but he has an updated version. It's called Palestinians, Invisible Victims. They'll also be made available after the event for free of charge, so please grab a copy on your way out. A little bit about for those of you who do not know, Dr. James Zugby co-founded the Arab American Institute in 1985 and continues to serve as its president. He's director of Zugby Research Services, which is a firm that has conducted groundbreaking surveys across the Middle East. For the past three decades, he has served in leadership roles in the Democratic National Committee and served two terms as a President Obama appointee to the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. He writes a weekly column published in 12 countries. He is featured frequently on national and international media as an expert on Middle East affairs. In 2010, Zugby published the highly acclaimed book, Arab Voices. His 2003 e-books, looking at Iran, the rise and fall of Iran in Arab public opinion, and 20 years after Oslo, are drawn from his extensive polling across the Middle East with Zoghbi Research Services. Dr. Zoghbi will speak for 30 to 45 minutes, after which we will have a Q&A session. Again, as always, we ask that you wait for the mic to come to you, please, before you ask a question, especially so that everybody can hear online as well. And for the online audience, you can tweet your questions to @PalestineCenter. Please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Dr. James Zoghbi.
Thank you. I wanted to begin with a little bit on the history of this book. I first wrote it in 1976. I was speaking at NYU on the problem of the issue of Zionism and human rights. And I took the paper that I gave to that gathering, and I published it in a book. The AAUG at the time, the Association of Arab American University Graduates, published it under the title Zionism and the Problem of Palestinian Human Rights. In 1980, I was invited to the first of the UN Special Unit on Palestine international seminars on the question of Palestine, to the Vienna conference, and I enlarged the paper and presented it there. And then in 1981, the ADC, I was the co-founder and director there, we published it in a book called It Palestinians, the Invisible Victims. There were about three copies left in print. I owned them all. And I just sat there on my shelf for years. And about a half year ago, I just took it out and read it. And I said, damn, this is pretty good. This says some stuff that people ought to know. And I guess what bothered me about it was the following. When it first came out, I made the ADL and AJC hit list. You know, it was I was an anti-Semite because I said these things about Zionism and I said these things about Israel. And how dare I accuse the Jewish state of deliberately expelling Palestinians, or et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you weather those storms. Somebody asked me recently, did that alter my career? And it didn't. It actually just reinforced my career. That's what I was going to be. I never wanted to be a podiatrist, and that was never, you know, just, that wasn't who I was. I was going to be an activist on this issue. And that was the price you pay for doing it. I started over the last couple of years, actually. I mean, Benny Morris came out with his book. But over the last couple of years, if you follow the press in Israel or the Forward or some of the stuff that Jewish Voice for Peace or other groups like that are talking about, a lot of this is there. You know, I mean, I remember reading right before the Trump visit an article on Haaretz about the Mukherbi quarter, where the Wailing Wall was. It was a very poignant story about how on one night in the 67 war, they just sent in guys with bulldozers and sledgehammers and destroyed an entire neighborhood, reduced it to rubble in order to create the plaza. And I thought, God, you know, they're going there to pray at this plaza over the ruins of the homes of 1,000 people. That was in Haaretz. There will be other stories that you will see in Haaretz about some of the things that Moshe Sharet had said in his fight with David Ben-Gurion over how the Jewish state should deal with the Arab population. And I got mad a little bit. I said those things 40 years ago, and he got beaten up for it. But now it's there. But an entire generation of people don't know it. So we decided to take the book and reissue it. You have an earlier version of the reissuing. It's now coming out again with Mondo Weiss, the website that I just love for its content. They are co-producing it with us with an introduction by Philip Weiss. And in a conversation I had with them, they asked me, you know, you said all this stuff 40 years ago. Do you feel like you were clairvoyant? I said, no, at all. Because, I mean, where did I get a lot of this from? I got it from Edward Said. I got it from Waleed Khalidi. I got it from Brahim al-Abid at the Palestine Research Center. This stuff, we knew this stuff. You just couldn't say it. You could say it among ourselves. We said it at AAUG conferences. But you couldn't say it in an American audience or you got blasted for it. But the time is now where you can say it, and you need to say it. And so we came out with the book, actually in the first week on Amazon, it was the number one new read. So I felt pretty good about that. So our tweets have borne some fruit. What is the book about? What does it do? What it does is it attempts to explain why Palestinians are invisible victims. In the introduction, part of my introduction was read to you. The issue that confounded me then, I was, remember, in 1976 when I was speaking at NYU first time on this, giving this paper, I was had founded the Palestine Human Rights Campaign. Why did we do it? What was it about? It was about trying to put a face on Palestinian victims. They were not known. And look, just think about it. We had a situation in Gaza, a massacre, 63 people, not a single face, not a single name, not a single human story. If one Israeli soldier had been killed, we'd know the name, we'd see the face, we'd hear the family. The evening news, I remember in a situation in 1981 where you might remember the bombing of the Fakhani neighborhood in Beirut. There had been a clash across the border in Lebanon between the PLO and Israelis. And that first night, one Israeli had died and two were wounded. CBS News turned it on that night and you had ambulances and, you know, flashing lights and the cameramen there, you know, catching all of this drama, and they interviewed the people in this Israeli settlement about the trauma of these people killed in this clash. In retaliation, they called it, the Israelis bombed the Fakhani neighborhood in Beirut, which is where the PLO offices were. And I think it was 283 people were killed in an apartment building that was devastated. And I turned on CBS News the next night, and the announcer was there in Israel saying, we bombed the whatever. The third day, the story came from Lebanon, and it was the guy stationed in Lebanon standing in front of an empty street of bombed out buildings saying, behind me are the buildings that Israel bombed and killed this many people. When I challenged them about it, the guy, the newsman from Beirut, came back with the explanation that they had gotten there that night. But he said it was too dusty and it was too crowded and too congested, and you couldn't get a picture of what was going on, so we decided to wait the next day so we should show the devastation. The point, in other words, was that for CBS News back then, the Israeli who died was worth the story of the ambulances and the turmoil and the people to be interviewed about how shocked and traumatic the event was. But in Lebanon, the story was the empty buildings that got destroyed. The people didn't matter. When Baruch Goldstein massacred people in the mosque in Hebron, the Washington Post had two front page stories on why did the good doctor go bad. One was on the front page, number one. The other was the front page of the style section. Not a single story about the Palestinian victims. Their names were never known. Their stories were never told. Their families were never interviewed. They didn't count. Not a new problem. It's an old problem. The question was, why did it happen? How did it occur? How did these people end up not being human at all? so that they became, as I like to say it, the Israeli people versus the Palestine problem. And you got to solve the problem so the people can have peace. That's all that mattered. Even look at the Trump plan today, what you see of the shell of it, the outline of it. It's all, it's like they're chess pieces on a board to be moved around so Israel will be secure. It's not Israeli people versus Palestinian people. It's Israeli people versus the problem. How do we solve the problem? That, I argue, in the book goes back to the very foundation of this dilemma. From the very beginning of this, when the British and French plans became known, Woodrow Wilson intervened, and he made his famous proclamation. There were a lot of problems with Woodrow Wilson, but he did make his proclamation about self-determination, and he said to the British and French, I don't agree. You cannot just do this. You can't carve this all up among yourselves. He said, it really should depend on what the people want. And so, being a pollster in the Middle East myself, I appreciate the fact that he commissioned the first poll of Arab public opinion, and it was the King Crane Commission. He sent over one American professor and one American businessman who interviewed a couple thousand different groups and people to come up with a comprehensive view of what the Arabs wanted in the post-war period, what they would accept. Well, we know the results, that they overwhelmingly rejected the mandate. They didn't want anything to do with the British and French. Back then, they did want the Americans involved. They wouldn't today. And they overwhelmingly rejected the notion that there should be a separate Jewish state on their territory. What I found interesting was that when told of this enterprise, polling the opinion, the declaration author, Lord Balfour, said, in Palestine, he said, we do not propose to even go through the form of consulting its inhabitants as to their wishes. Zionism is of far greater importance than the desire and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who inhabit that ancient land. Another British Brit at the time said, it's a false view of democratic principles that holds because a race or nation happens to occupy a certain territory, that territory is its for all time. Nor has any race the absolute right to determine its own future at the expense of some other race which may have more to give to the world. This was the foundation of this experience, this enterprise. Max Nordau, one of Herzl's colleagues, said, described the Jewish people as a people more industrious and more able than even the average European, not to speak of the inert African. The British saw Palestine as an important colonial outpost. And the way that they did it, the British and French had different ways of colonizing. What the British did was they sent companies to govern in their stead. So you had the India Company, you had African companies. The company that was going to do it for the Brits, they thought, was the Zionist movement. It was a perfect fit. It was like a marriage made in heaven. We need somebody to govern for us because it was the northern end of the Suez Canal. It was the eastern end of the Mediterranean. They needed somebody to operate in their stead. It was what Lebanon was going to be. The French way of doing it was to pit one group of people against another and cultivate one as the... So they cultivated the Maronites as their group that would provide the entrepot. Beirut was going to be the entry to their part of the Arab East. Palestine was to be the British entry point, and it was to be the Jewish people. This was Lord Shaftesbury. Syria and Palestine will before long become very important. The company needs capital and population. The Jews can give it both. And has not England a special interest in promoting such restoration? It would be a blow to England if either of her two rivals should get hold of Syria. Does not policy there exhort England to foster the nationality of the Jews and aid them to return to England? And then naturally belongs the role of favoring the settlement of the Jews in Palestine. It was a strategic partnership. It was a strategic partnership that saw the native no differently than they saw the natives in any other place they colonized, as trees to be removed from the frontier to make way for progress, to make way for a people who could give more to them and more to the world than the indigenous people of the land. And so from the beginning, Palestinians were a problem or an obstacle to be removed, an invisible set of victims. Zionism, which grew up in Western Europe as an ideology, now understand that it didn't have to end up this way. There were multiple threads of Zionism. There was a religious Zionism movement. There was a cultural Zionism. There was a Martin Buber who taught and thought that a partnership and a relationship can be developed between peoples that would build a prosperous land for both. He would have been a one-stater these days. But the political Zionist movement, which saw the displacement of the indigenous people and their replacement by them, under the patronage of a colonial power, them operating as a colonial power, was what ultimately won the day. And as I just hinted at before, there were disputes even within the political Zionist movement. I mean, Moshe Sharet, the first, one of the early leaders of the state and a prime minister at one point, actually disputed Ben-Gurion's whole approach when the point was made that over partition, the concern that the Jewish side had was that the partition was going to the UN partition was going to provide a bulk of land for the Jewish people and a bulk of land for the Arab people. The Jewish part was to include over 80% of all the Jews in Palestine, but it was still only 55% Jewish. 45% of it was Arab. And 34% of it was owned by Arabs, and only 9% was owned by Jews. And so it was not exactly their state. It was going to be, had more land ownership on the Arab side, and had 45% of the population was Arab. On the other hand, the Arab state was overwhelmingly Arab, and included land only owned by Arabs in that part of the area. The plan was, what do you do with this? And that was when the plan was developed to literally make the state more Jewish and larger. Ben-Gurion called it at the end a double miracle. We got more land and less Arabs. It was, again, they were like trees on the frontier to be cleared. It wasn't real people. What made the Nakba possible was that it was not just something that was desirable, but it was to be inevitable to fulfill the plan. Moshe Sharet didn't support it. And so you'll find in the writings here a dispute over, this isn't the way, this isn't who we are, this isn't how we should behave. He went along with it, but he still, in his diaries, wrote about his disapproval of it. Unfortunately, today, those voices have largely been silenced in Israel. And you have in the governing coalition people whose philosophy of how to deal with Arabs, it pretty much echoes some of these quotes from the turn of the last century, some of the same attitudes of Palestinians being less than human, less desirable, and needing to be removed and dealt with, from Avigdor Lieberman to Bennett and others. The dehumanization of Palestinians is quite disturbing. What is changing, though, is that here in the States, you have, in reaction to that, a kind of a split not only in the public opinion as a whole, but in the Jewish community in particular. And some remarkable groups, echoing again some of the earlier alternatives to Zionism. You know, the group Breira that existed way back when, it was founded as a group that was an alternative to Zionism. Zionism had said, political Zionism said there is no alternative but to do this. And Breira said there is an alternative. So they call themselves Breira, which means alternative. There's another way of being Jewish that doesn't mean another people paying the price. Breira was destroyed by the Jewish establishment, but other groups have now come today that are too strong to be destroyed. Groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, or If Not Now, are making real headway in terms of changing opinion among young Jews. I would say what's helping that is the marriage between Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump, which is really quite stunning. It's difficult if you're Jewish and you hate Donald Trump to find Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu actually agreeing on almost everything. And that creates an opening in consciousness that is changing the way people are seeing the conflict. And it's happening in the broader public as well. What I wanted to do when we came out with the book was to say, that's good that this change is occurring, but I don't want the change to occur just because people are angry with Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. I want them to understand that there's a history here that needs to be understood from the beginning, that an injustice was done to an entire people who need to have their faces written back into history. They need to not be invisible anymore. Doing what needs to be done is not something just because it's anti-Israel. It needs to be pro-Palestinian as well. This equation of how to deal with the conflict can't just be Israeli people and the Palestine problem, so you solve the problem so the Israelis can be secure. It's got to be Israeli people and Palestinian people finding a future where both lives matter. And so I'm hoping that the book will maybe stir some debate, maybe inform some people, and maybe create a sense of awareness about what Palestinians have endured. It tells the story not just of the pre-state period. It tells the story of what happened to the Palestinians who stayed behind from 48 to 67. It tells the story of what happened during the early years of the occupation. The book actually was written in 1981, but you already had a pretty horrible record of human rights violations at that point. And they've continued on and changed in scope. This is not the early years of the occupation we're living through anymore. It's a very different situation. But nevertheless, it's a story that needs to be told. And so I thank you for coming. I thank you for getting the book. You can, if you're watching online, you can buy it on Amazon. It's called Palestinians, the Invisible Victims. And I hope you will. Thank you. And I'll take any questions.
Jim, it's great to see you again. And you have done a wonderful work for the community. But I'm still disappointed that our voice...
Next question? No, sir.
Yes. It's coming up. It's coming up. It's all praiseworthy. I am wondering why we are not making our voice heard in the media. Why can't we have more Arab Americans write columns, letters, whatever, even buy space in the newspapers? Yeah. What is the problem? We have to do this immediately.
George, I can't speak to why more people don't write. I can speak to the media, though, and that is one of the huge disappointments I think we all of us have to deal with. There was a time when we literally were shut out of the discussion. That began to change in the 80s, and I think that the the war in the Gulf in 90-91 was maybe the high point where our voices were sought on a fairly regular basis, almost consuming basis, and there were multiple voices that were there. And that lasted throughout the whole Oslo period that followed. After 9/11, again, we were widely sought, and you had multiple personalities from the community who were on television fairly regularly. Largely, the questions that we were asked were had to do with, I sort of irreverently refer to it as, tell us how the little brown people are doing, you know. Is it really hard being Arab these days? You know, it was that kind of thing. When it came time to talk about policy issues, like what was actually happening in the region, they went to the experts. And in Washington and in New York, the experts are usually failed political leaders from past failed administrations, positions that were not open to us. And so if you were somebody who made a mess of the peace process over the last 20 years, you can be an expert at Brookings or at whatever, wherever you want to be, and man, the doors are open because we just need to talk to what's going on in the peace process, and we'll talk to the people who blew it 20 years ago. Or a disturbing phenomenon that has developed, I think even more so, is the networks talking to themselves. And it has become, I think it's to the detriment of all of us that reporters talk to reporters. Whether it's Fox or whether it's MSNBC or whether it's CNN, whatever the issue is, it's reporters talking to reporters. Tell me what you're reporting right now, and tell me what you think about what you're reporting right now. And damage is done because they're basically talking to themselves, reinforcing whatever bias or prejudice they already have. CNN's different because CNN has reduced it, I think, even lower down the scale, and that is we have somebody from the right and somebody from the left, and they just let them hammer it out as if there is no truth, there is no reality. What there is are two equal views, and we're going to let them make fools of themselves arguing with each other. It's done a great disservice to the political discourse. Now, I had my own run-ins with these folks. I used to do the Tony Snow show in the morning when that poor guy who passed away way too early was on. We had a respectful conversation for about 7 to 10 minutes in his Saturday morning show. It was great. Tony Snow died, and I very rarely would get calls. Some of the calls I would get are like this. And I might say in my own personal situation, I probably earned the right to not get called by the bookers because I was not nice. They would call me and they'd say, we want you to come on. Fox called and say, we want you to come on today and we're talking about Afghanistan. And I'd say, I don't know anything about Afghanistan. And they say, oh, it doesn't matter. We've got somebody from the right. We need somebody from the left. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't talk about something I don't know about. And the booker, she actually laughed. She said, nobody ever says that to us. I said, well, you know, call it the Zogby rule. I just don't want to do this. This is not. She said, but we'll get you the daily talking points. The daily wire stories, the stuff off the wall. I said, this doesn't matter. I'm not reading the newspaper and coming on and talking to you about it. I need to know something about it. And then one time I did Bill O'Reilly, and that was the last time I was on Fox because it was about Arafat. And he started to talk. Actually, there's a book that somebody wrote. This actually made it into the book. He asked me a question, and I said, I started to answer, and he interrupted. And I started again, and he interrupted. And finally, I said, Bill, I tell you what, where I come from, you were the host. You invited me. I'm the guest. That means that you actually owe me something, being polite. And if you listened, you might learn something and your people out there watching might learn something, but if we're just going to do this all night, nobody's going to pick up anything on this. Well, he shut up and he didn't say another word, but I never got called back again. CNN was different. CNN does the left-right thing, and so they want me to be on with Bill Bennett to talk about Iraq. And I said, what the hell does Bill Bennett know about Iraq? I mean, if you want to talk about, you know, drug policy, fine. Or you want to talk about gambling and losing a lot of money in Las Vegas, fine. But he doesn't do Iraq. But you're from the left and he's from the right. And that's the way they wanted to play it. And a good show was when you actually beat each other enough, beat each other up enough that they actually found it entertaining. And I don't want to go home every time I do a TV show and have to take a bath. And so I don't know if others reacted the same way, but frankly, that's what happened to me personally. But I found increasingly that the networks, like I said, have their own panels. And so you have, you know, this illustrious group of CNN people who are there to talk about whether it's impeachment or whether it's North Korea or whether it's Wall Street or whether it's whatever. Doesn't matter what the issue is. They're going to talk about it and, frankly, aren't experts. They are paid hacks, good word. Not mine, yours. No, but, I mean, that's actually the problem. And so we have largely become, I mean, there are some remarkable voices in our community, but look at after everything that happened in Gaza. Yusuf Munayyer was on, I think, one show, and Nora Erekat, I think, was on the network, CBS, the online version. The absence of them from the major shows was really quite striking. We had to work real hard. Andrea Mitchell is a friend, and so I got to do her show, and I think I did something else. Oh, Chris Hayes, yeah, he called unsolicited. But that's really a problem across the board. And so I don't know. What I do know is, though, that there are plenty of other venues that are available to us today to actually make news. And I see groups like I said, Jewish Voice for Peace and others actually making news right now. And we'll have plenty of opportunities between now and 2020 to do that. And so we just have to be more creative in how we create stories. Right here, you want to do it? And then here?
Just before, we have an online question. And the question is, what do you expect to be the future of Israel and the U.S. relationship as we start to see a shift in media being a little more critical of Israel?
I think that there are shifts occurring in public opinion. Like I said, it's a partisan gap that has opened and become deeper. I don't necessarily see a shift in policy yet. That will require a political change. And the political change only occurs in the context of elections. Our politicians have to know that this is... that there's a painful price to pay. I don't think we're there yet, but I think that the day is coming when, you know, when we'll see people responding to this issue because their pollsters or their consultants are telling them, you really don't want to go down this road right now because your electorate is just not there. It's going to take a little more, but I think that that's the direction you move in. Nothing will change in the relationship because even now, in the wake of everything that happened in Gaza, you have AIPAC working hard in Congress to get some pretty disgusting legislation out that basically wants to give Israel the store, maybe more access to U.S. weaponry than the U.S. military does. You have anti-BDS bills being dropped, one this week, I think it is. It's going to take more. Those guys who are doing this have to know and have to be made to feel when they go home that there's a political price to pay. I don't think we're there yet. Yeah. Here and then here.
Hi. I know there are certainly no simple solutions here, but I'm wondering about, are there any, what kind of parallels there might be with the African-American situation in the United States, with the Kurds in the Middle East, with the Catholic and the Protestant Irish. Is there something that you can learn from them, or you, or they can learn from the Palestinian movement?
I think that there's obviously experiences in many quarters that are there for lessons to be learned. And there are profound differences too. Obviously, I mean, the Irish experience in some ways is the same, but in other ways is very different. In part because you had a British government and an American government that were determined to come to a resolution. You don't have that here. You also had a flexibility, at least on the Catholic side in Ireland. I think the Protestant side needed some kicking and screaming and some assurances that they would be protected as part of the United Kingdom. But I also think that the South Africa experience, I think, has some parallels too. The difference there was that you had an African American community here that was far more substantial in its political clout and in its ability to move opinion. I mean, when black leadership here adopted South Africa and began, together with white allies, to do their strike, their sit downs in front of the embassy, we don't have the capacity I tried to organize a bit of the same thing over the embassy move, and really couldn't find a whole lot of interest. People want to do a vigil at the White House or a press conference here, but. And I think to some extent, right. I mean, when you've got a community that is such a substantial part of the Democratic Party, African Americans, organizing a sit-in and drawing a line saying this issue is absolutely central to us, that's fundamentally different than a community that is still struggling for acceptance here in the States, doing it without a whole lot of allies surrounding it. What's interesting, I think, is the extent to which these communities are now moving in the direction of understanding the Palestinian issue. And so it's not so much lessons learned from their experiences in other struggles as much as it is them feeling an affinity with what Palestinians are enduring. And we just honored this year at Gibran an Irish Senator, Frances Black. We honored her for a project she runs called the Rise Foundation, dealing with victims of what she calls the silent victims of alcohol and drug abuse, that is, family members who usually are ignored in treatment. You treat the addict, but the kids and the wife or the husband who've been victimized by this situation usually just are ignored. And so we honored her for that, but she also is chair of the Palestine Working Group in the Irish Senate and just came back from Gaza and gave an incredible, if you look on either my Twitter account, which is JJZ1600, or AIUSA, which is the Institute's Twitter account, you'll see a posting of Frances Black's speech in the Irish Senate, in which she's supporting legislation that would in fact call for Palestinian statehood and call for Israel to boycott products coming from the West Bank from settlements. Very passionate speech by an incredible leader, and I think, you know, that's having an impact on Irish Americans who see this great woman who they know as a singer. She's a very famous singer from the Black family in Ireland. Same with what's happening with young people and young American Jews in particular, who are just doing extraordinary stuff. I mean, the If Not Now demonstrations in front of the Trump Hotel were really important. And so they create, there is a kind of a new space open for debate and discourse on this that I think is quite significant. And that will feed on itself, and I think it's going to grow. Yeah? You have the mic. Who's the mic? Yes. Here? and then here. No, back then, back there, and then you. Sorry.
This to go back to the French and English British imperialism and the Balfour period early on. By the way, your speech was most interesting. Thank you very much. At that time, there was the, and I don't think you mentioned it, the presence of Germany as a rising power and very aggressive. And there were two world wars that we fought. And we got the money from Balfour went to the Zionist movement, to the Jews, and got the money for the arms. And that is why I think what I've read way, way back was the reason that the British were very grateful to the Zionists because they could get the money to buy the arms to fight the war. Now, I may be wrong, but I've read it.
I actually don't know. I mean, I know that people...
My father, by the way, fought in both World Wars.
I know that people have made the argument, Brits have made the argument, that that the British government wanted the support of the Jewish community internationally. It's never really put in those terms, but they wanted that support. The language that I have in the book and the stuff that I've known and have documented is the strategic value that they saw in Palestine of having a group who could colonize on their behalf this territory to protect it as a strategic asset. That was the part that I know and have documentation to show here and then here. And I understand the point, but the issue here is that, and I'm not going to get in an argument with you, but we're dealing with reality is never pretty. It's oftentimes unfortunate. What we must acknowledge, and there are by count 3 or 4 generations of people living in what is today Israel. They're not going anywhere, and it was tough for the Irish in the Republic to acknowledge that they've lived with this unified Ireland. It may come about. I actually think Brexit may hasten the unification of the island, because economic interest may end up dominating over the national identity. I mean, putting a hard border is going to be awful tough. You go to Ireland today, crisscross up and down, your GPS directs you through, you know, the shortest way from Donegal to Dublin is to go straight through a place that you could not have traveled before the Good Friday Agreement. And so do they want to go back to that? I don't think so. I think that, you know, we're going to see an evolution of this issue as we go forward, but we're not there yet. And I think that reality dictates that we understand that there are about 6 million people who call themselves Israelis and who live in what is today Israel, and how that works its way forward as we go into the future, Lord only knows. I mean, I used to debate this issue back in the 70s, and they'd say, do you believe in the right of Israel to exist for all eternity? And I'd say, I don't know. I guess that the Romans asked people that question too, you know. And I mean, I'm an American, and I actually love the opportunities that this country has given to me, the son of an illegal immigrant, to do what I do today. But frankly, America's not going to live for all eternity, and that gets people like in a tizzy, you know. And then they could pummel you alive and you know, eat your flesh over saying that. But the reality is that history is history. I don't know how it works out in the end. I mean, we elected a black president, for God's sake. Some white people are never going to forgive themselves for that or forgive the country for that. And they're still sort of, this is payback time with this guy. We don't know where it ends up or how it plays out. What I do know is that the struggle for justice, the struggle for human rights, the struggle for peace is what counts. And the form that it takes in the end, I don't know. I don't know where we go. What I'd like to see, what would I like to see? I'd like to see the land that Martin Buber wanted, the land that your relatives wanted, which is where, you know, people welcome each other and host each other and treat each other as equals and support each other when they're in need. That's what I would like to see. How do we get there? Well, first we've got to stop killing each other. And the way to stop that is to create justice, at least the modicum of justice that allows people to survive. And I think there are red lines to what is justice and what is not justice. From everything I've seen of the Trump plan, it is not justice. It doesn't make sense to offer somebody, I mean, it's like inviting a vegan to your house and putting a roast beef in front of them. It's like you know that they're not going to accept it. So it's a cruel, cynical ploy to say, here's the offer. A lot of tough work. I don't think America's ready for it. I don't think America will ever be ready for it. I think it's got to be internationalized, but we're not ready to surrender the reins on it yet. Too many people have died. Many more people are going to die. It's horrible. But the reality is we've got to acknowledge that today there are two peoples there that have got to figure out, we've got to figure out a solution that at least stops the shedding and begins to move us in the direction where we can accommodate and find a way forward. Do I think, look, I said one time, and I was speaking at a synagogue here, and they asked me what I saw the future. And I said, I look 100 years down the road, and I think that an Arab boy from Amman is going to marry a Jewish girl from Tel Aviv, and they're going to live in the suburbs of Damascus. It may sound crazy today. Actually, given when I said it, there wasn't Damascus was a very... But the reality is, you know, who would have thought you got a Polish plumbers in London? Now, a lot of Brits aren't ready to accept that yet, and so they want to play that game too. But we're moving in history moves in that direction. A lot of bounces, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of weird curves in the road. But at the end of the day, that's where we're moving. The question is, how do we not put up more obstacles to get there?
You've been listening to James Zugby, founder and president of the Arab American Institute in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBZ.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is it about some obscure pastor Erdogan's locked up? What's really behind the economic war now raging between the US and Turkey? Yes, further than NATO, from NATO every day, while all the focus is on this little-known US pastor arrested at the US coup attempt 2 years ago. So what is, and who is, really behind this latest breakdown in relations? And what's Erdogan and Turkey's position with the conflicts brewing and already happened in Syria and the Middle East? Also, we seem to be starting a series of Get to Know the Israeli Cabinet. Last week it was Justice Minister Eilat Shaked. This week we have a listen to Homeland Security Minister Gilad Erdan, who explains what he believes is the logic behind his anti-terror strategy. further east, we look at the mind control, yes, and extreme surveillance in China, which is overtaking the UK as the world's big brother state. Also, the slow crushing of free speech in Hong Kong, while the Chinese military do their biggest exercises ever off the coast there. The UN this week criticised China's so-called re-education camps, which are trying to wean a million of China's mainly Muslim Uyghurs off the Quran and onto President Xi's Little Red Book. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, an exclusive look at the effects of 8 straight years of austerity, with real wages falling while rents go up and up. More people are moving into vehicles and caravans. Are we seeing the start of a second traveller revolution, like the one Margaret Thatcher crushed, or tried to, at the 1985 Battle of the Beanfield? Author of the book of the same name, Andy Worthington, joins me, along with Sean, who was an HGV mechanic on the legendary Convoy. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. But Martin, we start this week by looking at Turkey particularly. Can we just put this whole thing into context? And why is Turkey such an important country when it comes to the conflicts that have been going on in Iraq and Syria?
Well, I mean, they refused to allow their bases to be used in the invasion of Iraq, in fact, so Incirlik couldn't be used. Well, Turkey's a very important country because of its geographical position. And it's a swing country, like Egypt perhaps was in the Cold War. So it's a very, you know, it's because of its geographical position that it's so important. And what happens there, is very important for what happens elsewhere, nearby and further away. But of course, most people in the West are blissfully unaware that as part of NATO, NATO has imposed a series of military governments on Turkey. And when the military seized power in 1980 in Turkey, there was massive terrorism going on, left-wing terrorism, right-wing terrorism, loads of people being killed. Then the military took over and it all magically stopped. And that's because NATO were running the terrorism and they also ran the military government. And then the military government in 1980 in Turkey actually imposed the first International Monetary Fund Structural Adjustment Programme, which was the beginning of the Reagan-Thatcher revolution in the Third World. But it was put through by a military government which came to power having orchestrated, and there's lots of people in Turkey who've investigated this, orchestrated the terrorism which then brought them to power, because that's what NATO does, and we're part of NATO. NATO's a terrorist organisation.
Certainly they are involved in wars and that sort of thing.
But no, they're involved in terrorism as well, Tony. Turkey, everybody knows it.
The main thing about Turkey is it's actually the second largest country in NATO.
Well, it's got the biggest army in NATO and so on, if they're going to stay in NATO or whatever. It's a very important country, and of course they were working very closely with the British intelligence services and the US intelligence services to run jihadis into Syria, including al-Qaeda, in order to overthrow Bashar al-Assad,
so
but they failed.
Why has Erdogan got rid of various newspapers like he did last year? I mean, it doesn't sound like he's very secure in his position if he's closing down newspapers and getting... I mean, he actually had the police come in and shut down one of the newspapers, didn't he?
He did, and Erdogan is not necessarily a liberal, but on the other hand, he has got popular support inside Turkey. People who think that he's a dictator are missing the point. He's got popular support, particularly in rural areas and the poorer urban areas.
So why has he locked up 50,000 Turks then?
Because there was a military coup in which hundreds of people died, Tony, and of course... It didn't succeed, but he's not very happy about it. And, of course, NATO was behind that military coup. We were behind that military coup. Erdogan is the elected leader. The PKK, who are political enemies of Erdogan and also military enemies of Erdogan, because they went back to war after ISIS bombed one of their rallies some years ago now, they opposed the military coup against them because they said, we're not having the Americans decide who runs Turkey, and we support Erdogan, we want to negotiate with him. Now, Erdogan is I'm not very fond of him. He was actually supporting, his son was supporting ISIS, as Putin pointed out, when the Russian Air Force started bombing all of these tankers that were taking taking oil out of ISIS-controlled territory via Turkey to be resold onto the world market, mostly to the Israelis, as it happens. And, of course, what's happened is that Turkey is run by a right-wing Islamist dictatorship, which was fine when it was aligned with NATO, but now, of course, becomes a terrible country that we've all got to wag our fingers at. Now they're starting to be unaligned with NATO. But, of course, the Turks should never have been in NATO. They were fools to join it.
Well, all this criticism of the Turks, particularly for this arrest of 50,000 people, the article today by Robert Fisk is in the Independent and I think in the IA newspaper. It says, a US trade war with Turkey over a little-known pastor. Robert Fisk is advising us not to believe a word of it. And he's pointing out that Egypt's president and Field Marshal Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has broken Erdogan's record by banging up 60,000 supposed Islamists in his own country's prisons. And he also says, what about Haider al-Abdi's mass hangings in Iraq? Or that nasty little post-death crucifixion in Saudi Arabia last week? Not to mention the horrid war in Yemen where kids are being killed all the time. Or the Israeli habit of shooting down scores of unarmed Palestinians in Gaza, or the chump Fisk describes him as in North Korea, who appeals to Trump's sense of humour.
Well, I mean, in a sense, Fisk is right about this. This is propaganda. Why do we hear about Erdogan? Because he's been singled out to be bullied by the Western powers. And we hear nothing about Sisi because he's aligned with us. And we hear nothing about Saudi Arabia because we're aligned with them and we're implicated in the killings that are going on in Yemen. But Erdogan has now, because he's moving out of the Western orbit, he's suddenly become public enemy number one. And, of course, the day before yesterday, he was our best mate, and he was helping us to infiltrate al-Qaeda into Syria from all over the world, Libya in particular, Abdul Hakim Belhaj, for example, and from Libya. And when he was on our side, all of his bad behaviour was completely ignored. Now he's starting to do things that the Western powers don't like. Suddenly we're reminded what a terrible guy he is.
This chap is called Pastor Andrew Brunson, who's been put under house arrest by Erdogan. But the consequences, we're being told to believe, are enormous. That the Americans have doubled US tariffs on steel and aluminium, and helped to almost entirely crash the Turkish lira, which lost 45% of its value this year.
Yes, and it's the courts which have refused to release Pastor Brunson because they claim that he's a CIA agent and that he was involved in the coup. And you know what, Tony? It may very well be the case.
So is it just because Erdogan doesn't like Christians?
No, it's because Erdogan doesn't like the CIA trying to overthrow him and nearly kill him. They intended to kill him, but because the Russians tipped him off, he managed to deal with the coup
so
attempt.
Anyway,
but hundreds of people died in that coup attempt. It wasn't a bloodless coup attempt. Loads of people were killed.
What Robert Fisk then attempts to do is to name what he believes are the real reasons. He doesn't believe it's anything to do with this pastor whatsoever. Firstly, buying the Russian S-400 missile system. Now, why might that be a reason to have an economic war on Turkey?
Because what Turkey is doing is trying to spread its bets. So it's been in the Western pocket for years, and they got involved in Syria on the understanding that they would get what they wanted with Assad, and we weren't. But then, of course, it didn't work out. And don't forget that the Russians helped Erdogan when he was about to be overthrown by the coup, and he's basically trying to he's trying to get friends all over the place. Why just be friends with the Americans when I can be friends with the Russians, friends with the Chinese? And the future of Turkey lies with being friends with the Russians and the Chinese. The past of Turkey is being in the pocket of the West and having various military governments which have oppressed
but
the people for years.
Why would it so upset the Americans?
Because they don't.
He's only trying to be friends.
Yes, but they don't forget they're trying to frustrate the Chinese One Belt One Road project. They're trying to recolonize Russia, get rid of Putin, and Erdogan suddenly turned out to be not a reliable partner from their point of view. Now, what's going on is everybody's having, they used to say that there's only one thing worse than being America's enemy, and that's being America's friend. And, of course, if you're America's friend, they just drop you like a hot potato when they've decided they don't like you anymore.
Or they do an attempted coup.
Or they do an attempted coup to get rid of you. That's right.
What about the fact that Erdogan is refusing to accept the US support for the American Kurdish YPGs? Allies.
Well, of course, that was bound to be a tension, because the YPG in Syria is aligned with the PKK, and the PKK have been there's been a horrible war going on in eastern Turkey in which tens of thousands have died. Diyarbakir has been reduced to rubble, but of course we've heard nothing at all about that because Turkey's on our side and part of NATO, and therefore he's not being accused of being a baby killer like Assad, although that may change. But of course there was always going to be tension about this, because the only people who would work with the Americans in northern Syria were the YPG, but I understand from what look at this week, the YPG have switched sides and they're now aligned with the Syrians, Syrian government.
One of the things that Robert Fisk says in this article today is that it was the Russians and Iranians who first warned Erdogan of the impending coup 2 years ago against him in July 2016. They had been listening, apparently, to the Turkish's military internal radio traffic and tipped him off.
Yes.
Is that true?
As far as I know, it is true. And, of course, Erdogan then owes Putin and he owes Rouhani, he owes him something. So now it's what Turkey could be doing now is moving out of the Western camp and into the opposite camp.
How come they're still in NATO then?
Well, they're not going to stay in NATO much longer if they keep taking Russia. I mean, he's buying in these Russian anti-aircraft stuff so that he can shoot down American planes. If there's any further, and Inkelik, his legal lawyers close to the government have said that they want to go into Inkelik Air Base and arrest various people, military personnel, American military personnel, who they think were involved in the coup. And the Inkelik Air Base is actually very crucial to...
pronounced Inkelik, actually.
It's very crucial to the projection of power by the US into the Middle East, and they could lose the base. But, of course, they can always have another attempted coup, or they could just bring Erdogan down by making the population rise up against him because they've impoverished them by putting sanctions on them. But I think that they may be overplaying their hand here. Erdogan simply turn around to the people who voted for him and say, you know why you're suffering? It's because the Yanks have put sanctions on us. Maybe we should leave NATO. And maybe that's it. Maybe NATO should just disappear. There's no purpose for NATO other than trying to oppress the people who are all over the world. I mean, NATO is fighting a war in the Hindu Kush, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Apparently, according to Robert Fisk, another thing Erdogan is doing, which is getting up Trump's nose, is helping Iran to dodge the US sanctions,
yes,
which were imposed after he tore up the 2015 nuclear agreement.
Well, you've got to recognise that countries like Iraq and Turkey actually have a border with Iran, and they do quite a lot of business with them. If the US puts sanctions on Iran, they don't do any business with them, so they don't lose any money. It's everybody else who loses money. So they're basically being told you can't have what would be perfectly straightforward economic relations with your neighbours, because if you do, then we're going to put sanctions on
you. What Fisk says is that Erdogan, in a decision demonstrating the cowardly response of the EU's own oil conglomerates to Trump's insanity, that's Fisk's word, has announced that he will continue to import Iranian oil. Thus, will Washington's further threat of increased oil sanctions against Iran be blunted?
Well, that's right. So, in other words, Turkey is now...
Why is the European Union going along with Trump?
The European Union has said that the European Union has said that they're not going to... they're going to encourage their companies to carry on doing business.
Encourage is one thing, though, but we know that any of the companies that do business with Iran will get sanctions imposed on them from the States.
That's the problem, because if you're a company doing business in the United States...
So the EU is effectively talking out of two sides of its face at the same time. It's saying one side, it's saying it's fine, British and all other European Union countries can trade with Iran, but actually the fact of the matter is they aren't going to be able to, and actually the EU is doing nothing about it.
Well, that's because the EU is in a weak position. Don't forget who really runs the EU and who really runs NATO, and it ain't the EU. It's the Americans. The Americans, and Trump is making it absolutely clear, we're the boss, you do as we say, or else. And in the past, they used to try and pretend that there was some kind of consensus being made, we will take your views into account. That's no longer the case. The EU is not in a position to fight a trade war with Trump unless they break with NATO. And ultimately, of course, this is what this could lead to. NATO could be destroyed. It should be destroyed.
Erdogan has made good friends out of Putin and Iran's supreme leader, and as an opponent of Saudi Arabia, is naturally on the best of terms with Qatar, whose emir, in a miraculous moment which even Pastor Brunson might envy, has just promised an investment of $15 billion in Turkey. Saudi Arabia's siege of Qatar is beginning to look as miserable as its war against the Shiites of Yemen. So there's this quite amazing alliance building between Qatar, which of course is where Al Jazeera is based, and the Turks.
It is, and of course previously Qatar and Turkey were very involved in the overthrow of Gaddafi. They've been very involved in the attempted overthrow of Assad, but they're now wising up and realising that being a cat's paw for the Americans ain't got a future.
Turkish troops are stationed in Qatar to protect the little emirate against its larger and threatening neighbour, Saudi Arabia. Well, is that a good idea? The emir might find those Turkish troops are starting to order him around.
Well, I think he was quite happy when they turned up. And of course, you've got to remember that Erdogan's AJP party is aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, which of course makes Egypt is not very happy because they're aligned with Saudi Arabia because they're against the Muslim Brotherhood. This is Middle Eastern politics. It's complicated. There's not just one lot of forces that on one side and one lot on the other. You've got multiple fractures and people trying to work out what their interests really are. But of course, what's actually underpinning all of this is that the Western powers and Al-Qaeda lost the war in Syria, and therefore there's been a change in the Rubik's Cube.
Talking of Syria, Russian troops are now patrolling the Syrian-Israeli lines below the occupied Golan Heights. The Russians have promised Israel that the comparatively few Iranian forces in Syria will be kept at least 50 miles from this sector. Russia's ally Syria needs to crush the final Islamist stronghold in Idlib with Russia's help and push the province's most intransigent fighters, Fisk says, back into Turkey. Qatar has the cash to rebuild Syria and thus extend its influence across the landmass of the Levant to the Mediterranean. If Qatar's going to pour even more billions into Turkey, we may see some kind of strategic alliance between Doha and Ankara and a rediscovery of the family friendship between Erdogan and Assad.
Well, that's right, because previously Erdogan said, Erdogan's policy is we're friendly to all of our neighbouring states. We're not going to get involved in trying to overthrow anybody. But he was persuaded by the British and the Americans to get involved in this madcap scheme to remove Assad. And of course, it was quite clear that it was NATO intelligence services which began the uprising in Syria and then infiltrated tens of thousands of crazies, some of them from Uyghur parts of China, into Syria to overthrow the democratically elected government, because they had a 2012 election in which Assad won handsomely, unlike Sisi, who's had an election, but the opposition were completely banned and less than half the population voted. But of course, we're allied with Sisi, so we don't hear about that. He's killed thousands of people, but we don't hear anything about that because he's on our side.
What about this business with the Golan Heights? Because we know that Murdoch and others have got oil franchises sitting there, but this is actually not officially Israeli territory. They took it in the 1967 Six-Day War, I believe, and yet they're now selling oil franchises to people like Rupert Murdoch.
Well, in international law, it doesn't belong to them, it belongs to Syria. And Assad has always said that when we've finished dealing with the terrorists inside Syria, it may be time for us to take back the Golan Heights. And the Israelis have got not a leg to stand on here. It doesn't belong to them. And so, yes, but we need it because otherwise we might come under attack. And, of course, they've been supporting the jihadis inside Syria. That's why the white helmets were evacuated from northern Syria via southern Syria via the Golan Heights by the Israelis. They've been providing all kinds of support to jihadis, Saudi-aligned al-Nusra, al-Qaeda jihadis inside Syria. And, people in the Middle East actually know what goes on. People in Britain in general don't know what anything of this is about. They think that we're against Islamist terrorism when in actual fact we finance and orchestrate it, and they just don't know the history. And, of course, the Israelis are a democracy, unlike Syria, etc. It's a complete farce, but that's the sort of stuff that, people are spoon-fed in the bubble of Middle England and Middle America.
Times of Israel today, Martin's reporting that in the Golan Heights, Russia is seeking a handover to UN peacekeepers in the area, and they have their own patrols now running along the border.
That's right. They're trying to get back to the status quo ante, which is where, you know, the Syrian government controlled all the way up to the border and the Israelis were in control of the Golan Heights. But it's still not satisfactory for the Israelis being in control of the Golan Heights. When Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, we said, Kuwait doesn't belong to you. You've got to give it back. But when the Israelis invade something, oh, no, you can keep that. And they're actually planning to completely annex it and make it part of Israel, even though the population isn't Israeli.
Well, Tuesday,
they're moving settlers
in there.
The
United Nations has got very different ideas, because on Tuesday this week, UN delegates in Damascus discussed peacekeepers in the Golan Heights demilitarised zone for the first time for many years. A delegation of UN commanders visited Damascus for talks with the Syrian Defence Minister Ali Abdullah Ayyub on the redeployment of the world's body's peacekeepers to the volatile demilitarised zone in the Israeli-occupied Syria Golan Heights. So is it feasible that the UN actually might do something after, what if it's 67, 70, 80, 90, that's what, nearly 50 years?
Well, the UN was used to have a tripwire force there, and they had one in South Lebanon as well. Ultimately, that's still not correct, because the Golan Heights do, and don't forget the Golan Heights have got lots of oil underneath them, and that oil could be used to rebuild Syria after the Israelis and the Western powers and Al-Qaeda have killed loads of people and smashed the infrastructure. They need that oil to rebuild. Why should the Israelis, who smashed Syria up, have that oil? That's not fair, that's not reasonable, and ultimately there's going to be a major Middle East war.
We've got an interesting situation here with the Russians on one side and the Israelis on the other.
Well, that's what's making the situation calmer, because the Russians are trying to calm everybody down. They're trying to interpose themselves into the situation and say to the Israelis, you back off, and saying to the Iranians, you back off. But ultimately, of course, that's not really fair, because the Israelis are the aggressors. They seize that land. It doesn't belong to them. It should go back to the people it does belong to.
All's fair, Martin, in love and war. You know that.
Well,
it's
indeed.
What you can get away with.
It's what you can get away with. But, of course, ultimately, if you carry on cheating, lying, stealing, ultimately you might lose. And that's what the Israelis have got to consider.
Now, we heard last week from Eilat Shaked. She's the Justice Minister from Israel. And I think we might have a series of these. Have a listen to some of these people and what they've got to say from the Israeli cabinet. And this week we're going to hear a bit about their policy to... I mean, because we've had such a horrific situation back in April and May this year with so many people, unarmed civilians, being shot dead by the Israeli forces. I wonder how this fits into their so-called Homeland Security, which is a sort of, I guess, it's like a sort of armed wing of the Home Office in Israel. So let's have a listen now to the Homeland Security Minister, Gilad Erdan, see what he's got to say about the way they're dealing with what they call is the terrorism by the Palestinians.
The two defining characteristics of the new wave of terror are, as I mentioned yesterday, one, the central role of incitement and radicalization, especially online, and two, the simplicity of the attacks, which are carried out by individuals with easily accessible weapons and without the command and control structures of traditional terrorist groups. Or to put it another way, high-tech communications and low-tech operations. Since the start of the wave of lone wolf terror in Israel began September 2015, we've experienced hundreds of serious terror attacks. In the period leading up to the outbreak of these attacks, and especially in the first half year of the terror wave, we were witness to an intense campaign of online and real-world incitement. This incitement, which continues as we speak, has a number of themes. Some are religious, such as the absurd and absolutely false libel that Israel plans to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. While this libel has no basis in reality, we saw it. It has led young religious Muslims to attack Jews in order, as they see it, to defend Al-Aqsa. Another theme is the glorification of terrorists. Those who've carried out murderous attacks are celebrated as heroes, martyrs, shahids, online and in the streets. This incitement also included an intense campaign of delegitimization against the very existence of the State of Israel. And, as you all know, when you delegitimize a country or its culture or its values, you basically legitimize violence against it. We have taken a number of steps to counter this incitement. None of these steps were simple. They not only presented operational challenges, but, as you know, many raise dilemmas that go to the heart of the balance that we all believe that is needed, between the right to free speech, for example, and the right to personal safety, between the individual's right to privacy, for example, another example, and the public's right to go about daily life without fear.
Well, the irony there, Martin, is he's talking about this September 2015. That was the Israeli Homeland Security Minister Gilad Erdan speaking just a few weeks ago. This was kind of put across as well. This was a Islamic mob, an Arab mob that the Israelis had to put down, and that it sparked off a whole load of knife attacks by Arabs on Israelis. But if you actually go back and have a look, you'll find that it was the main problem there was that the Israeli soldiers had actually stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Now, this is incredibly important contested territory here, this Temple Mount space, isn't it? And at the time, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the attack on Al-Aqsa following clashes at one of Islam's holiest sites. So a lot of it does seem to be based around Al-Aqsa, and it's difficult to extricate it. Whereas he's saying there that actually the idea that the Israeli state wants to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a libel. So where do you stand on it? Where do you think
well,
how do you make sense of this?
Well, let's put it this way. Settlers and extremist Israelis have been constantly trying to enter the Al-Aqsa compound. Ariel Sharon went there with a load of settlers before the first intifada in the 90s.
Just go back to September 2015. What you had was actually Israeli soldiers in the mosque.
Yeah, well, they go in with the settlers to protect them from being attacked by the Muslims, and that means that they're basically taking over the area. Now, of course, don't forget that the Israelis are not supposed to be in Jerusalem at all. The original borders of the Israeli state were all
focus on Al-Aqsa for a minute, mm-hmm. as he was doing, right? The Israeli security personnel used tear gas and stun grenades as they entered the compound to arrest what they call Palestinian stone throwers. So maybe they were children who'd run into the mosque.
Yeah, well,
surely the authorities got a right to run into the church.
Well, no, I come back to my initial point. When the State of Israel was recognised in 1948, it was given clear borders, and the borders definitely did not include Jerusalem. And, of course, they captured West Jerusalem in the 1967 war, and then they claimed that they were going to keep it. Now, in actual fact, if you take something in war and say, well, I've taken it in war, but we're going to keep it, well, the answer is, we're going to take it off you in war, and you're not going to have it, because there are no rules. You can just take what you want and you can keep it. When there's, in that case, we're at war with you. We're at war with you. And therefore, don't complain if somebody stabs one of your soldiers with a knife, because that's what's going to happen if you've got a war, isn't it? And, of course, all of the settlers' villages in the West Bank, do you know what they're justified by under Israeli law? They're justified as necessary for military purposes, that they need to have settlements in the West Bank for military reasons to keep the population under control.
Well, the settlers were very much involved in this incident in September 2015.
But that means
the manager of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Omar Kiswani, said to Al Jazeera that 80 Jewish settlers protected by the Israeli police attacked the mosque when confronted by Palestinian volunteer guards. A statement issued by the Israeli police said that masked protesters who were inside the mosque threw stones and fireworks at the police. So, I mean, you know, I guess this is just like, which side do you believe?
Indeed, and I come back to the main point, which is, should the Israelis be in Jerusalem at all? And of course, when the UN recognised Israel in 1948, it was given clear borders, like Serbia or anywhere else. But they've never stayed within those borders.
It's their Jewish homeland, Martin.
Well, what's the border of that Jewish homeland? They don't think
it must include Jerusalem.
No, it doesn't. No, in 1948,
that's the Jewish capital.
No, it doesn't matter. But in 1948, there was not a big Jewish community in Jerusalem. There was no just as there's not a big Serbian community in Kosovo, but we went to war with Serbia to prevent them having Kosovo. We dropped thousands of tons of bombs on them and killed thousands of civilians because Serbia was not allowed to have Kosovo. It used to be part of Kosovo, but now it hasn't got a Serbian majority. It's got an overwhelming Albanian Muslim majority, and we went to war with Serbia. And you know who didn't support the war with Serbia over that? The Israelis, because they knew exactly what the principle being created was, that you're not to have land grabs in the 21st century. Now, in actual fact, the Israelis have got to give up land grabs. The border between Gaza and Israel, the people in Gaza used to live on the farms, which the Israelis claim are theirs. And they say that the border between Gaza and them is a border. It's not a border, it's a ceasefire line. Now, in actual fact, there's never been a peace deal signed between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That means that everybody's at war, and the Israelis are going to have to stay at war until they play by the rules.
Gilad Erdan, we just heard from there, also was talking about online radicalisation. He's saying that this is one of the main things that they've got to stop, people getting radicalised online, although the evidence does seem to be that people are quite radical anyway.
Well, there would be. If you go around shooting people and oppressing them, they tend to get radicalised, don't they? That's what happened to the Jewish settlers in the 1940s.
But
the Irgun and the Haganah went around killing British soldiers because they were radicalised.
His answer seems to be to send little messages over to Mark Zuckerberg saying, please remove this website from Facebook.
Ahmed Tamimi had a Facebook account closed and all the rest of it. What they want to do is they want to control the narrative about what's going on. And, of course, when he talks about their delegitimization of the Israeli state, that is absolutely freedom of speech. The Israeli state was recognised within certain agreed borders in 1948. They have never agreed to settle for those borders. That means that the state is illegitimate and ultimately should be de-recognised by the United Nations. I say that absolutely openly. That's not an anti-Semitic position, that's a political position. And in Britain, we've got a particular responsibility because we agreed to hand over the Palestinian land to these to the Zionist occupiers that now are occupying.
I thought we were just driven out by a military means,
weren't
we? No,
but in 1917 we agreed that the Balfour Declaration was put together by the British and the Americans and the Zionists to create an Israeli state. And I think if the Israeli state continues to be an aggressive state, a problem in the Middle East, to the extent that it creates radicalisation so that we're being blown up in Britain because of the radicalisation caused by the Israelis, then we've got a vested interest in making sure they behave themselves for just looking after our own
best
interests.
Well, you're not the only person that thinks that, Martin, because also there's a chap who is the World Jewish Congress president. He's announced this week that he fears the impact of the Israeli government's destructive actions, which is a fairly strong statement for the president of the World Jewish Congress, Ronald S. Lauder. He's warned that the Israeli government, the likely impact of its destructive actions on the state's relationship with Jews worldwide. Writing in the New York Times, he argues Israel's government to listen to the voices of protest and outrage being heard in Israel and throughout the Jewish world. In particular, Lauder cites the decision in 2017 to withdraw from an agreement that would create an egalitarian prayer area at the Western Wall and propose a strict conversion law that impinges on the rights of non-Orthodox Jews. The president also pointed to steps taken this year, including a law denying equal rights to same-sex couples and the nation-state law, legislation that may have severe national and international repercussions.
Well, he's a moderate Zionist, and what he's saying is if you carry on being extreme, as the Israeli government currently is, then the question of whether Israel should be there at all is going to come onto the agenda. And I'm afraid I'm already there. There is a question whether they should be there at all.
I mean, why haven't we heard? We've heard a lot about Jeremy Corbyn. We haven't heard this, have we? According to him, many Jews now wonder if the nation they cherish is losing its way.
Well, that's because There used to be a liberal support for Israel on the basis that it was a democratic state with a strong labor movement, etc. But that's long gone. The Israelis themselves have killed off the two-state solution that everybody was talking about as a compromise. Now, if there's no two-state solution, then we're going back to a straightforward... Everybody is going to have to be a one-state solution. The Israelis can stay there. The Palestinians can come back from wherever they've gone. And then we'll have a democratic election and we'll see who runs Israel Palestine. And of course, in numerical terms, it won't be the Jewish population, it'll be the Arab Muslim population, who are always the majority.
The BBC this week, according to the Middle East Monitor, has bowed to pressure from Israel and changed a Gaza headline. The BBC once again has come under sharp criticism over its coverage of violence perpetrated by Israel against the Palestinians. Critics called the BBC out over its bias after the broadcaster bowed to pressure from the Israel Foreign Ministry changed the headline of a news piece concerning Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. The BBC headline read, "Israel airstrikes kill woman and baby," for a news piece related to the killing of three Palestinians, including a pregnant mother and a toddler in Gaza on Wednesday night. The headline attracted the attention of Israel's foreign ministry, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, who's leading a bitter campaign against Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, and the foreign ministry spokesman Emmanuel Nashon shot the BBC down and demanded for the headline to be changed immediately. So Israel airstrikes kill pregnant woman and baby then got changed to... I'll tell you what it got changed to in a minute, but this is a bit concerning when a foreign government can just contact a state broadcaster and tell them to change a headline like this.
Well, and then they give in and change it. I mean, they can contact them if they like, but the BBC shouldn't give in to that kind of pressure, but of course it does. And that's, of course, over time, creates a situation where the Israeli point of view and their way of looking at the world becomes ingrained in everybody else's point of view. And of course, that's just not right. It's just not right. They're basically making special pleading all the time. And, of course, when they were using aircraft here. They're using aircraft on Gaza, and, of course, the Gazans have got no aircraft. When Gaddafi did that, we went to war with him. When Serbia did that in Kosovo, we went to war with them. But the Israelis not only use aircraft on civilians, we pat them on the back and say, there, never mind. Now, this is totally incompatible. And, of course, in actual fact, the smart Israelis know very well that the war in Yugoslavia created the principle that there should be no ethnic cleansing. And that means, in actual fact, that a lot of Israel is an ethnically cleansed, unlegitimate state. And that, and, you
okay,
know.
So let me just clarify this. The two headlines. First, it was Israeli airstrikes kill three, including pregnant mother and toddler in Gaza. That was then changed to Gaza airstrikes kill woman and child after rockets hit Israel.
Yes. So, in other words, they say that they're trying to make it seem as if they're responding to some rocket attack. But of course, that's not even the case. The airstrike was nothing to do with the rocket attack.
Well, it might have been just a response to it. I mean, that may be correct.
No, it may be correct, and it may not be. And in any case, the BBC should be allowed to have their headline if it's true. And, of course, the fact of the matter is that most of the people in Gaza used to live on the other side of the fence in that part of Israel which Israel claims. They actually literally used to live in those farms.
Well, look,
it's their land that's been taken off.
It's really hotting up over there because this week we've had an Israeli minister saying Iran should disappear from the world. Iran should entirely disappear from the world. That's what Israeli Minister of Public Security Gilad Erdan, that chap we were hearing praying for earlier, had to say when asked about US President Donald Trump's decision on Monday to reimpose Iran sanctions that were lifted under a historic nuclear deal between Tehran and six world powers. That story was actually just this week, even though, of course, the Iran deal was dumped many months ago. So is that okay for the Israeli minister to say Iran should disappear from the world?
Well,
it's been there for quite a few millennia, hasn't it?
It has, and I would suggest that that's the sort of thing that if Jeremy Corbyn said it, it'd be calls for resignation. But when an Israeli politician says it, it's just, oh dear, never mind. Now, the fact is that the extreme right in Israel have taken control of the situation. They're already in possession of lots of land they shouldn't have, and through various wars. They're far more in defiance of international norms, far more than Serbia was in the 1990s. When are we going to war with Israel?
A top Syrian scientist is killed and fingers point at Israel. We hear August the 6th in the New York Times. Aziz Asbar was one of Syria's most important rocket scientists, bent on amassing an arsenal of precision-guided missiles that could be launched with pinpoint accuracy against Israeli cities hundreds of miles away. And he's been killed. But I think it was Charles Shoebridge that rather cleverly pointed out that, interesting, that the killing was claimed by a group linked to al-Qaeda, which might suggest, as often, Israeli al-Qaeda cooperation.
Indeed. Indeed, Charles Shoebridge, of course, used to be an anti-terrorist officer here in the Metropolitan Police. Al-Qaeda is a creation of the Saudis, the Western Intelligence Services, and Mossad. And therefore, Al-Qaeda, when it carries out attacks in Syria or in the West, is actually working with the Israeli intelligence services and with our own intelligence services. They are the terrorists.
Isn't it better that
we are at war with
isn't them? It better that these people get killed before they build these awful weapons?
Well, in that case, what we need to be seeing is some selective assassination of Israeli officials and military personnel.
I mean, it does suggest...
Because Al-Qaeda is run by Mossad. Never mind killing individual members of Al-Qaeda. Let's find the generals in Mossad who are running Al-Qaeda and assassinate them. Maybe Navy SEAL team should go in there and sort them out.
Martin, what's alleged is that this guy was actually running a chemical weapons facility.
Well, we don't know the truth of what he was or what he was doing, although there's a book come out recently you'll be aware of, Tony, where they admit they've been involved in at least 2,500 assassinations across the Middle East in the last 10 years. They claim to be a democratic state, but they're involved in 2,500 assassinations. If their politicians and leaders were being assassinated, they'd scream blue murder and say it's all terrorism. When they do it, it's fine.
So are Israel and Syria at war? Were these sorts of things?
Well, no, they're not at war because there was a ceasefire signed in 1973, which settled it was a ceasefire. But it wasn't a peace deal, just a ceasefire. And, of course, they've been intervening in the Syrian war to protect their protégés, including al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda. And everybody in Syria and the Middle East knows very well that al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, is Mossad, is MI6, is CIA. It's all the same stuff.
The Middle East Eye has been saying this week the Israel lobby is leading a witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn, and it has to stop. Britain's Labour Party's tearing itself apart over anti-Semitism charges disingenuously cooked up by political opponents. So Richard Silverstein in the Middle East Eye, in order to understand the true motivation behind Labour's anti-Semitism charges, it's important to focus less on the actual charges and more on the organisations making them, he says.
That's right. Well, Silverstein is a very honourable Jewish professor in the United States who actually lost his position in the university because of his opposition to Israeli policy. His parents died in the Holocaust. He's an absolutely honourable man, and he's basically pointing out the truth. The truth is that the Israeli state is far too big for its boots. They intervene in everybody's business. They tell the BBC what to do. They run al-Qaeda. They carry out assassinations. And many, of course, of the more extreme Islamist groups which they're opposing them are actually run by Shin Bet and Mossad anyway.
Again, back to Middle East Monitor, and Lieberman says war on Gaza is just a matter of time. It's only a matter of time before Israel launches a new offensive against the Gaza Strip. Defence Minister Avigdor Lieberman said yesterday, the Jerusalem Post reported him saying, the question of the next round of fighting is not whether, but when.
Yes, and if they use air power, no doubt the RAF will go in and shoot them down like they did in Libya. And then we'll bomb the Israeli military facilities until they agree to withdraw. That's what we did in Libya. That's what we did in Serbia. Surely we'll do that to the Israelis, won't we, if we're going to be fair about people who use overwhelming force against civilians? But, of course, that's not going to happen, is it? Ultimately, of course, what may happen is they do go to war with Iran and lose, because Hezbollah defeated them in 2006, and they don't. In actual fact, they can't win a war with Iran. So maybe it's time for bring it on.
Do you think that's an awful thing to say? Because there would be thousands, possibly tens of thousands, killed in Gaza.
Well,
why is it military fighting civilian population like that?
Because war in the modern era, Tony, 80% of the casualties are civilian. That was the same in the Second World War. It's the same in every war since. War kills civilians. Some of those civilians have got credit cards and friends in America, and they're real people, and some of the civilians are just poor, and they haven't even got access to the internet, so they don't count. Yeah, like children in Yemen, they're not real people. They're not real people that go shopping in shopping malls like in Israel.
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we turn to look at China because there's been a UN report this week which has pointed out that there are actually up to 1 million people in Xinjiang province, I think it's called, in the west of the country, who there are attempts to de-Islamify them. Now, Martin, this does sound a little bit sinister. I know you're a big fan of China generally. And also, at the same time, we've had the speech by the independence movement in the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong, which is supposed to... I mean, the Chinese have got very upset about that. They don't want any talk about independence. That seems to be completely off limits. And at the same time, the Chinese have been doing their biggest military exercises ever right next to Hong Kong. It's almost as if this is... It's almost inevitable there's going to be some sort of clash or conflict of some kind between the kind of remnants of the Western ideas of freedom of speech and being able to say things, even if you haven't got any political power. The Chinese don't like that at all.
They don't like it in Saudi Arabia, do they, either? But we're not invading Saudi Arabia, although the British Navy and the
Can we talk about China, please?
No, yes, we're talking about... We just mentioned it in comparison to other places. Why are we hearing about freedom of speech in China and not in Saudi Arabia?
Well, because there isn't freedom of speech in China.
Well, there isn't freedom of speech in Saudi Arabia, but we're aligned with them and we're helping in their war with the Yemen. When are we going to stop doing that, Tony?
So is it okay to hold, as we're being told by Al Jazeera, 1 million Muslims in China's secret re-education camps?
Well, I've read some things about what goes on in that part of the world, and of course some people in that province do not want to be part of China, but some of them are also engaged in terrorist activities in order to try and bring that freedom about.
A million people?
There was 1 million people. They say 1 million people have been put in through re-education. In other words, they're trying to persuade them.
Okay, so this is detention. Let's just make it clear. Yeah. More than 1 million Uyghur Muslims are estimated to be in detention in counter-extremism centres in China's far west, the vice chairperson of the UN Anti-Discrimination Committee has said this week.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, there's also strong evidence that the Turks, for example, the Grey Wolves in Turkey, the right-wing groups associated with the military, have been arming and training terrorists in that part of China to attack the security forces and police stations. And, of course, many of them have been sent via Turkey into Syria and are fighting in Syria with Al Qaeda.
We're not talking about Syria.
No, we're talking about Uyghurs. Uyghurs are in Syria. Quite a lot of them are in Syria.
We're talking about China, Martin.
Yes, okay.
And in China, do you think it's okay to make the disrespect of President Xi or the national anthem a crime with you can do up to 3 years in jail for?
No, China is not a Western democracy, Tony, nor is Saudi Arabia. But we're in alliance with one and we're opposed to another. We're actually opposed to what the Chinese are doing, which is constructive. When he said about they're having the biggest exercises ever on their coast, that's because the West has had the biggest exercises ever on their coast. We've sent our ships from Britain to China to have an exercise right on the Chinese coast. What if the Chinese Navy turned up in the Channel? What would we think of that? Would that be fair? Well, I mean, it's an international waterway, but if they turned up mob-handed with aircraft carriers in the Channel, would we like that? Or would we say that's not reasonable? But that's what we're doing. And, of course, what they're trying to do is overthrow the communist government of China. And they're
Do you think there's any likelihood of some kind of real conflict, war, whatever, breaking out in that part of the world?
Absolutely. Because the whole situation around the world now is a complete powder keg. Now, China is not a democratic country. But if you think the majority of Chinese won't support their communist government if it goes to war with the West, you're deluded. They will. They will.
Chinese surveillance has been expanding to Muslims who are making the Mecca pilgrimage. We've heard a couple of months ago, I'm not sure the actual date of that, that was actually 31st of July. China's close watch over its Islamic minority is being extended abroad as Muslims from Chinese regions make the Hajj pilgrimage wearing state-issued tracking devices. I mean, can't do that sort of thing over here, do we?
Well, no, but they're going to Saudi Arabia. Remember with Saudi Arabia I was mentioning earlier? These Chinese pilgrims are going to Saudi Arabia where they will
no doubt come into contact with Saudi intelligence and Al-Qaeda, and then they come back to China. Now, of course, we're keeping a pretty good watch on the Muslim community in this country because we think fear that they may do something.
Well, we don't actually seem to be keeping that good a watch, because many of them, these terrorist attacks that we've had, particularly the ones last year just before the general election, is that there was a perfectly large amount of warning because the MI5 had been informed about these individuals.
Yes, because in actual fact, most Al-Qaeda-linked groups are working with Western intelligence services, but you can bet your bottom dollar that the Chinese intelligence services know exactly that. They know that Al-Qaeda is the Western intelligence services, and the Western intelligence services are Al-Qaeda. And they know, because we've been pretty clear about it, that we want to overthrow their government. We want to get rid of the communist government of China.
I would suggest a very good force for the place to look for this stuff is the South China Morning Post, which is Hong Kong based, I believe. Taiwan has revealed a deterrent to China as satellite images show missile capable of targeting the mainland. Land attack cruise missiles would be capable of targeting Hong Kong and other coastal cities, but China has apparently got the defense systems to intercept it. So these are now in place, these cruise missiles in Taiwan.
Well, there's a potential for a war in the South China Sea. There's a potential for a war in the Uyghur region of China. And there's a potential for a war in Kurdistan. I mean, don't forget the Turks, because the Uyghurs speak a Turkic language. And, of course, some of them have been infiltrated into Syria via Turkey. And, of course, the Saudis are the place where Al-Qaeda was born. And if these people go to the Hajj, to Mecca, they could easily come into contact with Saudi intelligence. And the Saudis, of course, they're not a democratic country either, Tony, and they don't allow freedom of speech. And it could very well be that the people that go there to get support from the Saudi intelligence, they don't believe in freedom of speech either.
A lot of the sort of control freakery coming from Beijing is started in the spring when China's President Xi Jinping introduced a 5-year plan to Sinicize all the nation's religions by infusing them with Chinese characteristics such as loyalty to the Communist Party and to him. Over the last few months, the government's taken steps towards this measure by shutting down hundreds of private Christian house churches and also seizing Bibles. Now, what's that got to do with stopping terrorism?
Let's put it this way, Tony. If there was a less aggressive attitude towards the Chinese Communist government and we were all cooperating on building the One Belt, One Road project and cooperating together, the Chinese government could afford to be more liberal in its attitude to its opponents. But since there is actually an ongoing war of words between the Chinese Communists, who are aligned with the Russian Democrats against us, they're taking a paranoid attitude because they've got every reason to believe that there is going to be attempts to overthrow them.
How does that extend to, in March this year, a prominent Chinese house church leader was sentenced to 7 years in jail for building a Christian school in Burma?
Well, this is the Chinese government leaning on its political opponents. But of course, you can't build any Christian schools in Saudi Arabia, our allies. You're not allowed to show any kind of Christianity at all. It's forbidden, completely forbidden, Tony. But they're our allies. When are we going to war with them?
The surveillance state, I mean, it sounds a little bit like Amazon, actually, what they're doing over there in some factories. You have to wear a hat, which monitors your mood in China. And if it looks like you're getting too tense, you can lose your job.
China is not a democratic country. Why are we talking about China as opposed to Saudi Arabia, which actually invaded Yemen?
We talk about Saudi Arabia quite a lot, actually.
Yeah, the point is, all of this links together, yeah? All of this links together. We were talking about Turkey at the beginning of the hour. Turkey supports Uyghur separatists in China, just as the Chinese will no doubt be supporting the Kurdish separatists against the Turks, if that's the way the cookie crumbles. And in actual fact, there's just a load of hypocrisy about all of this from the West. The Chinese just think, when we go on about human rights, we're the ones with Guantanamo Bay. We're the ones with hundreds of people, thousands of people in these secret prisons all over the world. We're the ones who are running Al-Qaeda to try and overthrow Gaddafi. But we go on about... We
Let's
go on
look at some of the surveillance stuff the Chinese are up to. Facial recognition tech is now used for everything in China, from catching criminals in huge crowds to detecting and shaming jaywalkers to deciding whether someone can get an extra square of toilet paper in the public bathroom. Some employees have to wear helmets, as I said, that scan their brainwaves for rage, depression, anxiety or fatigue, and that alert their bosses to any perceived problems. Then there's the country's social credit system, which monitors millions of individuals' behaviour, including on social media and online shopping, and determines how moral or immoral it is, and then raises or lowers their citizen score accordingly. Those with a high score are rewarded, those with a low score are punished. They're also using drones a lot over there now for surveillance, and I might put a link up on our show page to their new drone, which looks like a flying pigeon. Anyway, that's all, Martin. Time for the Murdoch News at 8 now. This show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details are at thisweek.org.uk.
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, produced in partnership with Arab Studies Institute. I am Malihera Zazan. This week we bring you the second part of an in-depth conversation about the root causes of the protests in Iraq with Belsam Mustafa, a researcher in modern languages and politics at the University of Birmingham. Also this week we remember the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, who passed away on August 9, 2008, following complications after a major heart surgery in Houston, Texas. He was 67. All this coming up on this week's Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Last month, oppressive summer heat, lack of water and electricity, and pent-up anger against government corruption sparked mass protests in southern oil-rich city of Basra in Iraq. It quickly spread across the south of the country and into Baghdad. Momina producer Shahram Aghamir spoke with Belsam Mustafa about the protests in Iraq. Here is the second part of the interview with Belsam Mustafa, who is a PhD researcher in modern languages and politics at the University of Birmingham.
The record low turnout of only 44% of eligible voters casting their ballots in Iraq's parliamentary elections in May was also understood at the time by many Iraq observers as a sign of disaffection with the current political structure. It seems like these protesters, as we are watching the ongoing protests in Iraq today, these protesters are also disillusioned with the formal politics and the political parties jockeying for power. Hence, they have opted for another form of struggle, that is street politics, collective action in lieu of the ballot box. Is that a fair assessment of the situation? We can confidently say that there is disenchantment with the ballot box, which is sort of nationwide and it's not limited to one geographic area.
Yeah, of course. People try to send a message, not just to the government, not just the political parties, but to the whole world, saying that, look, we are not participating in the election. We are not going to vote because we lost faith in those political parties. And not just this, because, you know, you have the election law itself. People now are aware that this law has been basically designed just to reproduce and recycle the same old faces. So even if they go and try to vote, and although there is no alternative because largely they are the same political parties, but even if they manage to find, let us say, a smaller, more independent party, it won't win. It won't get an opportunity because of the election law and then the post-election alliances, again, based on the quota system. It's not just a loss in the faith, but also sending a message that, look, this has to change. The election law has to change so that we can fairly participate and vote for the people that we think represent us. The second message came just 2 months later when people took this to the streets. Because as I said, although the incentive of the protest was the basic demands, but if you listen to the chants, to the slogans, you could feel that it's much beyond than that. It's against not just the corruption, it's against all the political parties. And some of people raised this issue, really. They raised the issue of the elections law, raised the issue of the constitutions. But the problem is, I think, that people still lack political awareness, because when you hear someone saying we need the parliamentary system to be replaced with a presidential one, you could see that they still don't have this level of political consciousness, because a presidential system won't solve Iraq's problem. The problem is about the political parties, the political blocs, based on two pillars of leadership and also money.
And a system that was established in the aftermath of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq.
Exactly.
And fortified by the Iranian regime's intervention in Iraq by buttressing these political groups.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why you could feel this, that again, this was reflected in the chants and the slogans of the protesters, because basically they don't want interference from any other country. It's not just about Iran, but especially from Iran, because they feel that their intervention, their interference in Iraq was not for the sake of building a strong Iraqi state, but for powering themselves, powering through backing the parties, backing their armed groups, the militias, and contributing to the chaos and instability in Iraq.
That kind of explains why protesters were chanting anti-Iranian slogans. And these chants are taking place in areas where the population is predominantly Shia. This is also where the dominant political parties, except for the Sadrists, are considered to be close allies of the Iranian regime, as you mentioned. And the trigger for this protest was the fact that Iran cut off its electricity to Iraq in the middle of the summer, leading Iraq to lose about 1,400 megawatts of power. But surely, because of what you said, this could not have caused such a backlash or anger against the Iranian regime. But it had to do with the fact that it's a sort of a deeper question of Iran's role in Iraq.
Yeah, it's much deeper. Definitely agree with you. And I think that the issue of Iran cutting off the power supply is irrelevant to people's anger, because people are angry against the political leaders because they think they are responsible in the first place for allowing Iran to interfere, and against the negative role Iran has played in Iraq so far. They feel that Iraq is now the backyards for Iran.
And I think you could not say that 15 years ago in the aftermath of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, that those sentiments probably were not so strong at the time, against Iran, that is.
Yes, you could say that this was controversial, debated. Now there is almost an agreement, I wouldn't say by all people,
of course,
but I would say by the majority of Iraqis. It's against the idea of interference because they want to see their country as independent, which has respected, I mean, relationships with all its neighbors, relationships that serve the interests of the country rather than those of the political elites or the armed groups. But this never happened. Iran was one of the key countries that has been meddling in Iraq in a very negative way.
Of course, if you bring up this subject in a conversation with the Iranian regime officials, they would say, wait a minute, we are the ones who actually help Iraq get rid of major threat that was Daesh, ISIS, in the north. That's what they would argue. They would say, well, look, this is our contribution to the Iraq and its future.
Yeah, they can say whatever they want, but Iraqis, they wouldn't believe and they wouldn't be convinced anymore. The ones who saved Iraq are Iraqi volunteers, Iraqis who, I mean, went and fought ISIS. You know, and also there was the coalitions, the security forces who were backed by the coalition. But I would say mainly the volunteers, and those. This is the paradox, because those southern cities have contributed large numbers of its young people to the fight against ISIS. If you go to them, even in Baghdad, you would see that the streets are covered with the images, the pictures of martyrs who gave their lives in the fight against ISIS. And there was an outrage in the electoral campaigns just before May elections, because when politicians tried to remove those pictures and replace them with their posters and banners.
And they should not forget about the role clearly played by Kurdish Peshmergas in fighting the ISIS and pushing them out. Another counter-argument, to of course, to the Iranian argument would be, would there have been any ISIS and formation of Daesh in Iraq had it not been for these sectarian policies and the policies implemented by the government itself that helped the genesis of such forces in Iraq?
I would say there are multiple factors at many levels, but this is, of course, one major factor that led to the rise of ISIS in Iraq.
So since we are talking about Iran, what is your understanding of why Iran cut off its supply of electricity to Iraq? Saudi Arabia seems to have made an offer to Iraq, which involves the construction of a solar farm to sell electricity to Iraq at a price which is a quarter of what Iraq pays for electricity supplies from Iran. What is behind Iran's cutting off supply of electricity to Iraq, as well as what is in Saudi's mind?
To start with the Iranian cutoff of power, there are two narratives. So one by Iraqi officials saying that the cut was because Iraq did not pay its bills or debts to Iran. But then there were statements by Iranian officials saying we had to cut off because we are going through a local and domestic conditions because of we have high demands and pressure inside Iran and we could not supply power to Iraq anymore. In terms of Saudi effort, I can't tell what in there in the minds of Saudi, but I would say that for the sake of investments, if it does not carry any other political intention or comes with any other, you know, something that we don't know, something that's behind the scenes that's would work against the interests of Iraq, or of course this is something that no one would accept. But if it's something that would help Iraq, if it's if we take it as good intention, as investments, why not? But again, it won't solve Iraq's main problem. It might be helpful for a short term, but not for a long term. The main issue is the political system in Iraq itself.
Well, Saudis clearly are going against Iranian hegemonic influence in Iraq.
It could be, yeah. It is one of the possible scenarios, I mean.
You know, Balsam, I should have mentioned when we were talking about the formation of ISIS, one of the main reasons ISIS was born as such had to do with U.S. occupation of Iraq and removal of Saddam Hussein at the time and aftermath of the occupation in terms of the constitution that was formed, the political structure that was formed, and so forth and so on. But at the time, we were just talking about the Iranian role, of course. We did talk about some of these political parties and their role or lack thereof in this protest. Let's talk about the role played by the Shiite religious leadership in Najaf and Grand Ayatollah Sistani. It took 2 weeks of protests before these Ayatollahs, if you like, and the Marjaya Shiite leadership characterized the protesters' demands as legitimate. What do you make of the stance taken by these clerics? Does this religious leadership still enjoy strong support among the protesters and perhaps in the area in general?
People reacted in a very unexpected way when the Marjaiya did not mention the protests a couple of weeks ago in the Friday prayer speech. And there was criticism in the streets and on social media against the Marjaiya, which is something I think it was unprecedented, because you know how highly revered the Marjaiya is for Shia. So to see that people are starting to criticize, you could feel that the Marjaiya is beginning to gradually losing force, you could say, when you hear people criticizing it. And because of this pressure, because of this criticism, the Marjaiya responded by bringing up the protests and the protesters and referring to their demands as legitimate and standing, you know, saying that we stand with the protesters and their demands. But again, their reference to Iraq's need for a really strong a very strong and brave man to take lead. It again shows that the Marja'iyya is not quite aware of Iraq's problems, because this isn't about one leader who could solve Iraq problems. It's about a whole system. And we, as I mentioned, we'll always go back. You can see that this is really a circle, because the main issue in Iraq is the election system, the quota, the election law, sorry, the quota system, and then the corruption, the blocs and alliances formed along sectarian and ethnic lines. And this is the main issue. And the Marja'iyya want, I mean, they would always say that we stand with the people, and but that's all. It's all vague. There are no clear stances. There is no clear stance or detailed stance. And after each speech, you would hear the politician saying, look, we support what the Marja'iyya says, and we support the protesters' demands, and we support the rights, and we will all fight corruptions, and they're stuck in a circle, and nothing changed. You can't say it started to losing support, but you can say that it's a gradual decrease in its force. Among people.
It kind of takes time for these things, as you say. These are
Yeah, it will take time, but now that it's controversial, and this was not happening before. So you could not see people criticizing, like, openly and publicly the religious authority. This is something quite new, and of course it will take much time to reach the point where you can say it's now losing support.
Again, another sign of how identity politics is not the only, the predominant dynamics in Iraq anymore. Let's talk about the local power dynamics in Basra and the south. The paramilitary forces loyal to different parties, as well as armed tribal forces that you mentioned earlier, seem to control the second largest city, Basra. Can you briefly explain who these people are? What is the way they actually exercise power?
Well, on the one hand, you have local provisional council of the province, and it's present in every other Iraqi city. But there is also different Shia parties, especially Dawa, Badr, Fadila, and Hikma, and every one of them has their own armed group or militia. On the other hand, there are the tribes, and the tribes are powerful now. They have money, they have weapons. One of the most powerful tribes in Basra is Al-Battat. And because, especially since 2014, and because of the fight against ISIS, and because, you know, the security forces were busy fighting ISIS, this created a vacuum in the south, especially in Basra, which has been fulfilled by those militias and the tribes. And there is like a power struggle between them to control the resources and to benefit as much as they can from the resources of the city itself.
I mean, even going back to 2006 and 2007, there were tensions within the city, and there were armed confrontation between different militia groups in Basra. And what you're saying is there is still some of that, plus the fact that there are tribal forces involved too, so there's confrontation between different tribes as well as between different militias and the tribes.
Yes, because, yeah, I think it has gone beyond control, really, because they are really empowered now. And there is another thing, to be honest with you, because I think the parties also contributed to empower the tribes. So if you also look back at the electoral campaigns before May election, you would see that all the political parties would go to the tribes to try to buy votes for themselves and for their parties. And of course, there are certain bargains, compromises between the two. So they benefit from each other. And because there is no independent judiciary system, and because the rule of law is really weak, so this has given rise to the tribes to take control and to have more power in the south. And not just in the south, it's also in Baghdad. A couple of weeks ago, there was an incident in one of the neighborhoods in Baghdad where a tribe was trying to seek revenge for the killing of one of its members. So there was a family who were killed, I think, and the tribe went to the accused person's house and they start to fire it with arms. And this happened in the broad daylight. And the state didn't do anything about it. There is an Arabic and Iraqi term for this. They call it al-degge. So when they have, the tribe has its own system of seeking justice. So they go by themselves and they try to fire at the accused person's house just to frighten them and to tell them that we will seek revenge for our victims. And this is very dangerous, really, because this is the capital. That's why it's spread. And it's not just about the South. It's not just about Basra.
There is this argument that, I mean, you kind of alluded to it in your talking about the tribes and militias in the South, that some of this is caused by the phenomenon of weak state. This happened under Saddam Hussein's regime during the sanctions as well. And he had to empower other tribes in other areas as a base of support. In return, he allowed them to do things such as having their own courts. And instead of a civil law, you were dealing with some of these tribal laws and tribal rules.
Yeah.
So that seems to be a concession by the state sometimes. There's horse trading between these politicians and the tribal groups.
I think it's very normal. I think it's everywhere when you have like a weak law. This will give the place to tribes to control.
Is it true that when a petroleum company wants to drill for oil in an area in the South, it would have to make payment to the tribes that have claims over those areas? The payment has been described as protection money, basically.
Yeah, there were claims. There have been claims of tribes imposing taxes on the oil companies and also getting millions of money. So the money ranged between $25 million to $100 million.
Yeah.
Because they think that this is the area, their area. And from what I read from the official statements and media reports about this, it started because, you know, the government tried to reach a concession, a compromise with the tribes when the oil company started first to come to Basra. So they promised them compensation just to allow those oil companies to work in places or in areas under the control of certain tribes. But then there is a backlash because the tribes started to ask money from the oil companies. And yeah, there were reports that some tribes, some of the powerful tribes, including Al-Battata tribe, getting millions of monies from oil fields companies. So there were claims, yes, there are certain reports talking about this.
It sounds like if they don't pay, threat is that your facilities will not be safe. They could be attacked.
Yeah, and then that's why some people also blame the companies because they see them as collaborating with the tribes and with the corrupt officials.
Yeah, talk about the oil companies which operate in southern Iraq and their practices. There seems to be quite a bit of resentment towards these companies.
From what I'm hearing from the protesters, so the number one resentment is because of the foreign labor, because they believe that the government should have, when they contracted with those companies, they should have requested that there is a certain percentage goes for the locals. But this didn't happen. And others say they actually, that the government asked them to hire local people, but they didn't abide by that, and they brought their nationals to work instead of local people. So there are, two different narratives. And also there was some people blame the companies for, again, collaborating with the corrupt officials, with the tribes, because when they pay and when they make those concessions, they are contributing to empowering the corrupt leaders, the officials, and also the tribes.
Oil is a major factor in the dispute between the Basra province and its local officials and its population, on the one hand, and the central government in Iraq. Basra oil fields produce roughly 3.8 million barrels per day. And this is about, if I'm not mistaken, that's about 85% of entire oil production in Iraq. The Basra province generates something like 65% of the GDP, gross domestic product, in Iraq, while the employment benefits they get from it is very little. Basra is supposed to receive $5 for every barrel of crude oil, that is sold by the central government, $5 for every barrel of refined oil. It is also supposed to get half of the border fees from ports and land crossings. Basra is a port city, and also Basra province has the only access to the sea. The Basra province argues that the central government has not paid its promised share of the revenues. Hence, there is a tension.
Well, again, this is controversial because, yes, there are some petrodollars that the government has a promise, but these allocations, these petrodollars allocations have been frozen because of the deficit, basically, in the state's budget. But again, this is not the central issue because it's all about corruption. I mean, in 2017, the previous governor of Basra, Majid al-Masrawi, he was accused for corrupt bargains and contracts by the Higher Commission of Integrity. But he could manage to escape because he has double nationalities, and he escaped to Australia via Iran, and he's the governor. What I want to say that, yes, it's true that those petrodollars allocations are frozen, but even if they are released, there is no guarantee that Basra's problems will be resolved because those in power are the same, I mean, members of the same political parties people are protesting against. It's not just in Basra. Again, each province has its basic budget allocations, you know, to pay for the employees' salaries, etc. And but again, where is the money is going? Because if you look at Basra, you can only see garbage everywhere. There are no projects. There is no infrastructure. Local politicians are really linked and tied up to Baghdad's governments and politicians.
Basra in 1960s and 70s was a thriving city.
Indeed, you know, and it is considered the Venice of the Middle East. In Iraq, we call it Al-Fayha, which means a spacious place, because we are in the context, I mean, of the protests and the basic demands. But Basra is one of the great city in history and its culture. And it's not just about economy and oil. And it's really a shame that Basra is like that in 2018.
I was looking at contrast between a couple of photographs of almost the same location next to the river banks. And I was looking at a photograph from back in the 50s. Versus one from 2018. As you said, the whole place is littered, polluted.
You would feel this contradiction if you look at pictures of all Iraqi cities in that period of time, in the 70s or the 60s. And now, but especially in the case of Basra, you know, it's not only about the post-2003, but also before that, the war with Iran, and the sanctions, all cities have suffered greatly. And then situation has only gotten worse and worse in post-2003. Basra is a place for, you know, the leading Arab linguists, grammar schools, you know, of Al-Farahidi. And yeah, so what I want to say, it has a really cultural significance, beyond just economy and oil and all other economic resources that it enjoys.
Since we are talking about Basra, on July 24th, the head of Basra Provincial Council announced that 15 out of the 25 members of the local government had signed a petition to establish an independent region of Basra. Yeah. What can you tell us about this announcement? Does this request reflect the general sentiments of the population in the province? The protesters seem to be disillusioned with the entire political structure. On the other hand, there is this issue of local versus central government.
I think it's a diversion from the protests' main demands, and especially to cover for the corruption and failures of the local government in Basra. But at the same time, they brought it to the discussion because they know they would appeal to some people in Basra who aspire for an autonomous region, just like Kurdistan in the north. But this is, again, it's not one of the demands currently raised by the protesters. It's not about that. The local province, they did so. They did request that in 2015, but they couldn't achieve anything because they were faced with disapproval by the federal government, and there were lots of obstacles because, you know, there is a legal process. This is something that cannot happen overnight. And they know, and they quite realize that it's just a means of deceiving the population and trying to absorb their anger and also diverting the protest from its demands. And maybe because the protests lack leadership, and this is where some actors are trying to fulfill this gap. And this could be one attempt by the Provisional Council in Basra to bring this issue now.
When I was reading about Iraq, there's mm-hmm. this issue of poverty and employment that has created a fertile ground for a thriving drug trade involving crystal meth mm-hmm. in Basra. Mm-hmm. That's a fairly recent phenomenon. The drug evidently still comes from Iran, and mm-hmm. it would go to other countries from there. But now much of the drug stays in Basra, evidently. Mm-hmm. And there are reports that the drug trade involves Shia militias and tribesmen yeah. in that region. Yeah. And some of the prominent officials who are colluding with drug smugglers. There are even reports that meth labs have been set up to produce the drug in Basra itself. How widespread is this problem of addiction in Basra? It's a fairly recent phenomenon, isn't it?
It is, and this is a very good point to raise indeed, because it's a very serious and problematic issue that has not been addressed by the government or even by other sectors in Iraq, like media. It's not just like being a crossing point for the distribution or the smuggling of drugs. For example, I've been reading some reports about farming certain plants. And it's not just in Basra. And this is what's very concerning. It's really widespread across the country, in cities in the south, in Baghdad itself, and also up to Diyala and in other cities. No one is shedding enough light on it. The number of addicts is on the rise. The number of people who are arrested is increasing daily. And there are lots of really key dimensions here at play. The social, the cultural, and the political, because as you said, the tribes, the powerful militias are involved trying to exploit this, because this is another source that they can benefit from. And also because of the unemployment and poverty had led the young to take this route. And there is Iraq lacks rehabilitation centers. It lacks the necessary means, I mean, to treat those people. It's really problematic, and I think it's worth a coverage or another episode on its own to highlight the different dimension.
Is it mainly crystal meth?
There is a number of drugs, but I think the crystal meth is the most widely used.
Going back to the protests, some protesters torched the buildings used by Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi's Da'wah Party, mm-hmm. the Supreme yeah. Islamic Council Party, as well as the Iranian-backed militias, such as al-Badr organization, Asaib al-Haq and Kitab al-Hizbullah, yeah. who also received their fair share of public anger in this protest. These are militias who have been forced to reckon with in the fight against Daesh. Nevertheless, the objects of these actions, so the protesters are taking quite bold steps in terms of articulating their demands and expressing their outrage.
Yeah, I think this was unprecedented action. And it happened, you know, after a protester was killed by the security forces in Basra. This is when things escalated and when the protests spread across the southern cities. And we saw the protesters targeting and approaching, surrounding not just the provisional buildings, but also, as you mentioned, the headquarters and also the offices of leading Shia parties and their militias, which again is expressive of the anger of the public and the disillusionment with those parties. And it was not just the offices of political parties, but also in Najaf, there was a very important thing that happened when people stormed the Najaf International Airport. And they stormed it not to for the sake of vandalism or sabotage, as they were accused by political leaders. No, on the contrary. They stormed the building because the Najaf International Airport has been controlled and run by Shia Islamic parties. And they are, again, accused of financial corruption. Because of this, they later forced PM Haider al-Abadi to dismantle the board of directors of the international airports and bringing it back to the federal government's administration. So this was something that the protester was really credited for. In terms, I mean, of the political parties, which were involved in the fight against ISIS, people do realize, because as I said, many of the volunteers, the majority of volunteers actually who joined the security forces or the paramilitary, the PMUs, come from the south. So they differentiate, they see them as political parties involved in the political protests. They differentiate between them and the fighters who just went to fight and many of whom lost their lives. And this is interesting because people started to realize that this is not a single, the paramilitary units is not a single homogeneous group, but there are various groups and many of whom are involved in the government, are political parties, and they are backed by Iran. And that's why they express their anger, because the protesters are against all the political parties. There was one protester, for example, who said that his son is in Hashd al-Shaabi and he didn't get any money. They don't know where the money goes, but they didn't receive any salary or nothing. And they are protesting.
Hashd al-Shaabi is the popular mobilization forces.
Mobilization forces, yes.
So the protesters, clearly, based on what you have been saying, are distanced from the institutional power and former political parties. And given the absence of defined organization and clear leadership, how do you see the future of these protests?
Well, I think their strength in the first place was because they were spontaneous. That's why they really posed a threat to all political parties. It's a kind of a blessing and a curse at the same time not to have a leadership. Because without a leadership, the protest could be exploited, could be hijacked to different political parties or other actors. And I think 3 weeks after the protest started, we started to see this. I mean, the involvement of the tribes and the protests and the committees, the coordination, they call them Lijan Tansiqiya or coordination committees in every province. They are drafting list of demands which are really unrealistic and they cannot be implemented at all. And they are drifting, I mean, the protests to a different direction. On the other hand, there were the oppressive measures taken by the government. So I think they could be undermined, weakened, but they would definitely take place again. They would definitely recur. And I think this could be not just in certain provinces in the south or in Baghdad, but also it will spread across the country. Because, again, the infrastructure, the base upon which Iraqi state is built is the same. And if this is not going to change, so all of those problems, this circle of disservice and disillusionment will continue. And the anger, you know, will explode at any point, sooner or later.
Momina producer Shahram Al-Ghamir spoke with Belsam Mustafa, who is a PhD researcher in modern languages and politics at the University of Birmingham. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish passed away on August 9, 2008, following complications after a major surgery in Houston, Texas. He was 67. Here is Sinan Antoun speaking about Mahmoud Darwish and his legacy.
He started writing poetry at a very early age. He learned to read and write on his grandfather's lap and then, of course, went to school. It is said that on the, you know, the celebration of Israel's Independence Day, which for the Palestinians is the Nakba, he wrote a poem and recited it, but the poem was antithetical to the general atmosphere because it talked about a little boy who had lost his house and whose family had lost their farming land and everything. And he was summoned by the Israeli officer the next day and threatened and told that his father would lose his work permit. And Mahmoud Darwish said that at that day, and on that day and at that very young age, he realized the power of words, and he realized that this was not just a game, but a very powerful game, and continued to write poetry and became also politically active. The important thing to remember is the first decade or so, the Palestinians inside Israel were living under military rule, and they didn't have a freedom of movement. It was constrained. So they lived under military rule, and it's important to remember that he had lost his house and his family had lost everything when he was still 6 years old. And when they were forced to leave their village, you know, in the chaos of the Exodus, he was lost for a few hours and his mother had to look for him in the dark. But also he was marked as a refugee, having gone to Lebanon, you know, he was called a refugee by others. And even after coming back, they returned to another village, not to their old one, which was completely decimated. So they lived as internal exiles, and he did so from a very early age. And then he became politically active in the Israeli Communist Party, which was back then the only party in Israel that allowed Arabs to work. And he began to publish and became quite famous. So by the time he left Israel in 1971 on a scholarship to Moscow, he was already famous inside Palestine and in the Arab world. And it's important to remember and emphasize that he was imprisoned 3 times because of his poetry, not because of any act of violence. He was imprisoned 3 times. He was put under house arrest for a long time, and he was banned from leaving Haifa, where he lived as a young man, for almost 5 years. So in 1971, when he was in Moscow, he decided not to go back and went to Cairo for a year and then to Beirut and then to various exiles.
There are always notions of exile and identity. They're very, very evident and explicit in Mahmoud Darwish's poetry.
Well, it's evolved from the initial simple universal gesture of, you know, I exist, I am who I am, I want you to recognize me, exemplified in his poem, Write Down, I'm an Arab. He evolved into starting to celebrate, if the term is correct, eternal exile, knowing that perhaps he could never, ever go back in his lifetime, at least, like many of the Palestinian refugees. He started to celebrate eternal exile, but also the notion of home changed, since home for him was destroyed and forever lost. Home became his language and his poetry, because at a certain point the idea of the homeland was being threatened with erasure, so he kind of mythologized it. But afterwards, and that's where his genius shines, I think, once he realized that he made a monument out of this lost homeland, and he himself had become such a myth, a mythical figure with huge symbolic capital, he started to demythologize it, especially in his later poetry, to celebrate an eternal journey and to say that the road, as he says in his own poetry, the road to home is more beautiful than the home itself. Now, it's important to understand that that doesn't mean that home is not important, but for people like him, for whom the West Bank and Gaza are not really their home. He is from the Galilee, and that's where he grew up, and that's where he belongs. As he said, going back to Ramallah, to live in Ramallah, is still a kind of exile for him, because that is not his home. And that is the tragic aspect of his life and even of his death, is that even in death he was not allowed to go back and be buried close to his family. And it's important to remember that he was not allowed to return to Palestine or Israel all those years. And every time he returned, which is only a few times, once to attend the funeral of the famous Palestinian novelist Emil Habibi, and the other time last year, it was with a special permit from the Israeli authorities because he was banned from returning to his country.
Mahmoud Darwish has been called many things, national poet of Palestine, the voice of Palestinian people, the poet laureate of Palestine. And in a 2002 interview, he said that being the iconic voice of Palestine is a burden to him.
Well, because there were pressures placed on him, consciously and unconsciously. People expected him always to write the kind of poetry that they wanted to hear. So we spoke of write down I'm an Arab. So whenever he went to a poetry recital, people always wanted the old Mahmoud Darwish, but he wanted to be a poet who always developed. While he, of course, wanted to write about the suffering of his people, but he also wanted to write about the suffering of individuals and about himself. So he did not have the freedom that other poets have, because he wrote a whole collection about love and erotic themes. Some people got upset and said, how can the national poet write about love? But it's amazing how he navigated all of that, and how with every new collection he wrote in a different style, and with time he forced his audience and the readers to develop with him and to be always ready and open to his new experimentations, and to understand that while at a certain point it was important to preserve Palestine in memory and in reality, but perhaps it's also important to move on and to celebrate the Palestinian as an individual and a normal human being. The Palestinian doesn't have to be always the hero. He or she should also be the fragile, normal human being. And while one should celebrate one's triumphs and one's resilience, one should also celebrate one's weaker points. And it's important that he also calls himself, when he was asked, how do you see yourself? He said, I see myself as a Trojan poet, meaning history has given us Homer and the discourse of the victors. He says that I want to search for the voice of the Trojans, the voice that was lost. And he also celebrated simple life. And it's important to remember that one of his most famous lines, which says, you know, we love life when we have time to do so, meaning the stereotypical image of the Palestinians as loving death. This is how he countered it, by saying that we actually love life. And even though he was against Oslo, but he returned to Ramallah to live as a citizen, and he said that the next challenge for Palestinians was now that perhaps, or it seems that this one major confrontation or battle has changed, it's important now for us to write about simple and normal things. We don't always have to write about heroic themes and major epics.
As he changed his poetry, did people's relationship to his poetry changed, or it always remained the same?
Well, he was asked once, you know, do you think you still have your old admirers? And his answer was beautiful in that he said, it's like a train where some people get off the train. You know, there were some people who still are, who only like his older poetry and don't like his newer poetry as much. But then he says that new people got on the bus. So his poetry always had a massive impact, not only on the street, but also on the literary establishment, on the critics. There are very few poets who managed to be so popular with the average people, but also be successful with the critics. It's mentioned time and again, but it's important. Mahmoud Darwish could get thousands and thousands of people to show up to his poetry recitals. A number of times he recited poetry in sports stadiums and they were full. And wherever he goes, it's always full and it's always sold out. And his poems were put to music by Marcel Khalifa and became very, very famous. But it's the poetry for daily survivor. There are many, many stories of people who were in prison and were being tortured. I read this just 2 days ago. And one of them used to recite Darwish's poetry to himself to stay strong, but also his beautiful love poetry. A lot of young men would use his love poetry with their lovers and with their girlfriends. And another important aspect is that people used to carry his photographs, pictures of him in political demonstrations. It's a very well-known story that one of the Palestinians who was getting beat up by an Israeli soldier was asked, who is this in the picture about Mahmoud Darwish? And he said, it's my uncle. But later they discovered that it was Mahmoud Darwish, and then they banned Palestinians from carrying Mahmoud Darwish's photographs in demonstrations. So that tells you something. And his contribution to Arabic poetry, modern Arabic poetry, is immense. I mean, with modern Arabic poetry, we had a move towards prose poetry, and most poets have abandoned writing with meter and rhyme. Mahmoud Darwish, because of his mastery of the tradition, is able to keep writing in the traditional form with meters and rhymes, yet he had so mastered these meters that when you read his poetry, you see how it's musical, but it's closer to the conversational style. But another important thing is his diction. His diction is very rich in the kind of words and also in the kind of images that he uses. So he's really enriched the language with the kinds of words that he uses and also with the metaphors. I always like Heidegger's words that language is dead metaphors. You know, all of these words that we take literally started out as metaphors, but then they died. And then poetry comes and gives new verve to the language. And this is what he has done throughout his poetry, and especially in the later years, really complex and beautiful metaphors in very simple, almost conversational language.
That was Professor Sinan Antoun speaking with Malihi about the late Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. Next, we hear Professor Antoun reading some of Mahmoud Darwish's poetry, which he translated from the original Arabic, as well as poems from a book entitled Unfortunately, It Was Paradise. Sinan Antoun's co-translation of Unfortunately, It Was Paradise was nominated for the Pan Prize for Translation in 2004.
Think of others. As you prepare your breakfast, think of others. Do not forget what doves eat. As you wage your wars, think of others. Do not forget those who seek peace. As you pay the water bill, think of others, those who are breastfed by clouds. As you return home, your home, think of others. Do not forget those who live in tents. As you sleep and count the stars, think of others. There are those who cannot find space to sleep. As you free yourself with metaphors, think of others, those who lost their right to speak. As you think of distant others, think of yourself and say, I wish I were a candle in the dark. I thought that I had died on Saturday, so I said, I must stipulate something in my will. I did not find anything. I said, I have to invite a friend to tell him that I am dead, but I did not find anyone. I said, I must go to my grave to fill it, but I did not find the way, and my grave remained empty. I said, I must do what I must. Write the last line on shades, but the water spilled onto the letters. I said, I must do something here and now, but I did not find an act worthy of a dead man. I screamed, this death has no meaning,
absurdity and chaos in the senses. I will not believe that I have died a full death. Perhaps I am somewhere in between. Perhaps I am a retired dead man spending his short vacation in life. Mercy Bullet. I am jealous of the horse when its leg is broken and it feels the insult of its inability to attack and retreat in the wind. They treat it with the mercy bullet. As for me, if something is broken in me, physical or moral, I ask that a professional killer be found. Even if he is one of my enemies, I will pay him his fees and the bullet's cost. I will kiss his hand and the gun. And if I can write, I will praise him with a precious poem, and he would choose the rhyme and the meter. With shyness. With shyness, I listen to an old song on a scratched record. With shyness, I smell the scent of a rose that is not mine. With shyness, I scratch a body part. With shyness, I use my five senses. With shyness, I succumb to my sixth sense. With shyness, I live as if I am the guest of a gypsy who is about to depart. In Jerusalem, I mean inside the old wall, I walk from one epoch to another, without a memory to correct me. There, prophets share the history of the sacred. They ascend to the heavens and return less crestfallen and less sad. Love and peace are sacred and coming to the city. I was walking over a slope and thinking, how can narrators disagree on the light speech in a stone? Do wars break out because of a stone's dim light? I walk in my sleep. I gaze in my sleep. I see no one behind or before me. All this light is for me. I walk, run, fly, and become someone else in the manifestation. Words bloom like grass from Isaiah's prophetic mouth. You will not be safe unless you believe. I walk as if I am someone else. My wound is a white evangelical flower. My hands, two doves on the cross, flying and carrying the earth. I don't walk. I fly and become someone else. There is no place and no time. Who am I? I am not I in the presence of the ascent. But I think only the prophets spoke classical Arabic. What else? What else? A female soldier shouts suddenly, "It is you again. Didn't I kill you?" I said, "You killed me. And like you, I forgot to die. There is no city in the city, no here except there, and no there except here."
That was Sinan Antun reading the poem, "I Belong There," from Unfortunately It Was Paradise, selected poems of Mahmoud Darwish. Sinan Antun's co-translation of Unfortunately It Was Paradise was nominated for the Pen Prize for Translation in 2004. And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
Coyote is the government. The fire next time. As California burns in the summer of 2018, I remember the words of a Native American elder. I met him 20 years ago at the gathering of the Pitt River tribes below Mount Shasta, California. Mr. Willard Rhodes told me the story of Coyote. He seduced the people into violating the laws of nature and of right living, and how Old Man, the Creator, responded. It reminded me then, and even more so now, of the African-American spiritual. God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time, with one important difference. In the story told by Willard Rhodes, the Creator punishes transgressions by sending first the ice and then the flood that we know as Noah's flood. However, the fire next time will not be set off by the Creator. The fires that can destroy the earth will be ignited by Coyote and by the people in a terrible act of self-incineration. Willard Rhodes passed away on September 12, 2006. To this day, he's missed by the Pitt River tribes and his family. Here's my introduction from the original broadcast in the year 2000. Mr. Willard Rhodes received the story of Coyote from his grandfather and grandmother, who saw the future before it had arrived. I met Willard Rhodes at a summer camp on the land of the hereditary chief of the Ajumawi, a position that was eliminated by the U.S. government when they replaced traditional governments with their tribal council systems. Not far from the land where I met Willard Rhodes was a U.S. Army fort from which, beginning in the 1850s, the Army ventured out to kill or forcibly remove as many of them as they could find. Only a few families survived by hiding in the mountains. Willard Rhodes is one of the last elders who remember the rich heritage of the Isatwe. He learned the cosmology of his people that sees the earth and the stars in the galaxies as cells in a heavenly body. He was taught to read petroglyphs and to understand how these huge rock carvings were made without the use of modern tools. Willard Rhodes told me that he was born in Goose Valley, in a little town the Indians call Uwumpki. He spoke about his father in a way that showed the love and respect he had for him. His father had a small ranch and was able to feed many people during the Depression. His grandparents were the source of his stories. They were told him at night when he slept in their room. Even after he began making his own living at age 14, as construction worker and ranch hand, he returned to their house to learn. The story of Coyote and that of the spider and the lizard were told to me on a very hot day in view of the massive snowy volcanic cone of Mount Shasta. The sounds you're hearing come from the children playing, the wind, and a drum in the distance. Here is Mr. Willard Rhodes.
The coyote is the government, or the people that work for the government, the police, anybody that wears a badge, anybody that tries to overrun other people, that's the coyote. There's very few people within the law that have a humane feeling. They all have to do exactly what that badge permits them to do. They can't do anything without jeopardizing it, and they're afraid they'll lose their job. And that's what I mean about the coyote. So the Indians had a way of telling the story, so they used this old coyote for a lot of different things.
Was it coyote who brought the automobile?
Well, the old coyote refixed those automobiles. He's the one that had them made. That's the large corporations, whatever. So he made an automobile. And it hurt people in the end. It's destroying and hurting people more and more and more. Everything that the old coyote fixes hurts people, such as the dams they put in the rivers. What does it hurt? It hurts all the fish. It hurts all the animal life that lived along that river. It hurts the people, and it poisons the water. In the first place, the rivers were clean, and it was always running free. When they dammed them up, they started getting dirty and rotten. The shellfish that lived in the rivers are all dead or all full of bugs or worms. That's what the old coyote does. Everything that you try to make better in the end hurts you. That's the coyote.
What about TV?
TV is poison. TV poisons children's minds. It gets them to where they don't think right anymore. They think that the TV is something that's almost real. Everything is fixed like that. It's fixed to brainwash children. Even to education, schools, is fixed to brainwash children. Before, when children went to school, they started in at the first grade. They were probably 6 to 7 years old before they started. Everything that you learn before that age stays with you. You don't forget that part. So what do? They take the little children, 3 years old, send them to the little preschool, and they regimentate them. You sit down and you take orders. Whatever somebody says, you have to do. And that goes on from preschool to kindergarten. That's the time that they are implanting their thoughts within that children's mind, the old coyote's thoughts, not humane thoughts. They take the humane feelings away from people. And then all through school, what do they teach you? They teach you how, well, I always call it percentages, how to give a man a dollar and get back three. That's what they teach you in school, is always how to get more for what you give. And if you don't believe it, just look what happens. Look at your own education. What did it teach you? Education is a two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. But most people use it to cut the wrong way. If a person uses this education to help people, then it's all right. But if he uses education to take away from people, then it's wrong. And 90% of them use it to take away from people. On the world before this one, people had everything that's imaginable. Everything that you have today, they've had then. This is why they said, whatever you build or whatever you do, it's already been done. So don't do it. So the people got to the place where they didn't need the Creator anymore, and they said so. Look at us, what we've got. We've got all the food we need. All we have to do is get on our web and talk, and it's brought to us. And it was brought to people by other people that weren't people. In other words, robots, because they were made by man. They didn't have a mind of their own. They just done it. And that's when the old man got angry. He said, well, if the people don't need me anymore, I don't need them either. So I'm going to destroy this world. So he told his helper, who was the fox, or we call him Kuan, he said, you gather the people that remember me, and you make the web like the little spiders fly in, and we'll move the people that remember me to another world that I have already fixed for them. I've already fixed it. So the old coyote got word of it, and he rushed around and he got a hold of the anchor that was holding the ship down, and he wouldn't turn it loose. And he begged, he said, take me with you. I know what you're going to do. You're going to destroy this world, and I don't want to die. And if you take me with you, I won't do the things that I've done before. I won't teach him this. And the old fox, he said, well, if you do that, I'll take you. But he said, you got to promise that you won't teach the people that way anymore. All right, he said. So he took him. He got on and he brought him. Well, when they landed, or just before they landed, in our stories, they were coming up Pitt River down the canyon down here. And the old coyote looked out, and the ship was flying right close to the ground, and he said, that looks like a pretty place. So he jumped off. And his footprints are still in the rocks down there. About a summer seven shoe or moccasin foot, right side by side. And then the ship came on over and it landed up here by Pittville, and that's where his house was. And he lived there for a while. And then he rebuilt everything he fixed to people from there. And that was way before the freeze. And then he told the people, and if you do the things you've done before, we'll freeze you to death. But I'll save a few that remember me. And he's always doing that. But they couldn't get rid of the old coyote because he was already here and you can't kill him. You can't kill a spirit. So the people lived, and finally they got to doing things that they weren't supposed to do again. The old coyote said, well, we ought to fix this over. It's not good enough. We'll rebuild it. So the old man froze him, froze this whole country. Now, this has all been proven by things that have happened. They know this world's been frozen. And he said, if you do it again now, after he fixed it, he said, if you do it again, we'll drown you. So it went on for a good many years, and finally he got tired and he said, well, you people don't behave. You're going back to the ways you done before. So he said, I'm going to flood this world. But he said to his helper, he said, you make two canoes, two boats. You make them out of redwood, he said. And he said, and you gather food and you put in one boat enough to last 7 years. Because he said that's how long it's going to be flooded. That's so everything will die. So he got ready and he fixed these two little boats. He put all the food in it, and the old coyote, he come along again. He said, I know what you're going to do. You're going to drown all these people. He said, I don't want to drown, suffer. He said, so take me with you. I don't want to get all wet and suffer for this long. Fox said, I'll take you, he said. But he said, I want you to go crawl in the end over there and don't you peek, he said. Well, Coyote said, all right, I'll do that. I won't look. But when he got in there and started to rain and flood, he made a little hole in there and he watched what was going on. So when the water went down and it landed on this island here, and there was nothing here. It was just a rock pile. And the old coyote said, how are we going to live? There's nothing here. So the fox said, I made another place on the other island, he said, and you can go over there and you teach there, he said. Don't teach the people like you did before. You teach them the right way, and they'll survive. Everything will be all right. But if you teach them wrong, he said, you're going to destroy yourself again. This time you'll burn it. So he went over to the other side, and he started teaching the people wrong from right there, as soon as he got there. So now the destruction is coming. The next thing he said, this time we'll burn it, and you will set the fire. He's talking to the old coyote. You will set it. Now, the coyote in this part, who is he? He's the people themselves. So then he went on to tell how they were going to do it. He said, when they build a ladder to the moon, he said, the oldest one is going to shoot first, he said. Then the young brother will shoot next because he don't want to be beat. Then they'll build the steps, platforms, whatever you want to call it, he called it steps. Then he said they'll build a house. And when they put that house upon the moon and the people start to occupy it or live in it, when they put their knee down to go in, he said, that's the time, he said, that the ladder will break and the people will fight, the two brothers. And he said the ocean between the two countries will boil because they'll drop baskets full of ashes in it. Now that's coming, and it's getting closed. They have built these houses already. They've done it twice that I know of, rebuilt it twice. The next one is going up there because everything happens in threes. Everything. Even life is in three stages. Take a look at a butterfly, for instance. A butterfly has three lives, three different forms of life. People have three different forms of life. All animals have three different forms of life. All vegetation has three different forms of life. Think about it.
How do people have three different forms?
They're an egg first, a fertilized egg. Then you come as a little person. Then you come as a after, like your spirit goes on to another life. So you have three different forms of life.
You know, I just interviewed somebody who said the oceans are getting warmer.
When you drop things in the ocean, when you put things in the water, what does it do? It starts in the bottom, starts to foment, and creates a heat. Look how much trash, garbage, that they have shoved into the ocean. No wonder it's heating up. Look how much atomic energy has went into the ocean that they have already used.
What do you have to do now to protect the earth here in your area?
Try to educate people not to do what they're doing, not to create or rebuilding something that is destroying themselves. Stop it. Quit while it's still safe yet. Atomic energies or whatever there is. Don't give those scientists any more money to create this destruction that they're creating. Everything that they create, everything that they fix, everything that they do is harmful. Go back to where the Chinese made gunpowder. That was the start of it. All right, when they made it for pleasure. Something that they could look at popping and making noise. But the other part of the coyote, he took that and said, I can make missiles out of them. I can make something that will kill people. a long ways off. I won't have to use my arrow anymore. I can get rid of that sword. I won't have to use that. I can just pop them off. So he created that. And it's got worse and worse and worse. First it was just an old single shot gun that they had to pour powder in and tamp it down and set it off with another little dose of powder with a match to shoot it. And now it's an automatic thing that they can just load it up and pull the trigger and it'll shoot it 1,000 rounds within minutes. That's what I mean by the old coyotes always fixing things better. What's going on here is going on all over the world. All over the world, everybody is into this mess. And there's people all over this world that is fighting it or talking about it. But the government or the old coyote is a little bit bigger than they are and overrides them. Coyote is a lot of different things. The government, corporations, timber outfits, munition factories, car factories, everything. Cities. People that live in cities. Where do they get their food? From the store? Well, that's people's thinking. But they don't get it from the store. They get it from out here on the little farms. But they're destroying the farms now. They're building more cities on the flat ground where they could raise food. They ain't building them up on the hillside where nothing grows. They're building it down on the good ground. That's the coyotes thinking, because it's easy to build it down there. So these are the things that I talk about. These are the things that I was taught when I was a little boy, and I never forgot it. That's why my people were called the people with ears. Isatui means people with ears, people that listened and heard all these things. That's the whole land of my people. Then there are little other names that go within that land to where we came from, who we are. This is why I even tell some old people, such as I said a while ago over there, I don't open my mouth because I don't hear old people talking about what they're supposed to be talking about. They're always talking about their griefs they have with the government, how the government treats them. Well, that's kind of their own fault because they let it happen. And they let money get in their way, and they think about money more than they do about life. I never did think about money. I really don't care about it. I just got enough to live on, and that's all I care. And everything will come around someday. It'll all change because our stories tell it. He said that the people will get mad someday and destroy the old coyote. And then everything will start growing good again. There'll be plenty of food. And then the old coyote will come back and he will join the people.
That was the story of Coyote, told by Mr. Willard Rhodes from the Isatwe Band of Pitt River Indians near Mount Shasta, California. We were sitting on the banks of a river in view of Mount Shasta in the middle of a summer camp of the Indigenous Environmental Network. When I thanked him and was about to leave, he gave me another story. Here is the journey of the lizard and the spider.
Two boys were sitting on their house. One of them was listening on his web. The other was watching, looking across the other side. And one of them was the little spider. He was the one that was listening on his web. the little lizard, that little tiny little lizard, you don't never get over an inch long. He was looking across the other side. Now these two, this little spider listens on his web all the time. He makes that little antenna and he listens on it. That little lizard can see a long ways. He can see a little tiny bug way over there and he'll go over there and catch it. And these were watching. And that's the reason they used these two names. And they said, looking and listening, and they said, well, the people on the other side are forgetting their teaching. They're forgetting. And they're doing things that they shouldn't do. Maybe we can go over and help them. Maybe. So we'll go talk to our grandfather. So they went down and they asked their grandfather. He said, we want to go across the other side because the people over there are going wrong and we might be able to help them. Grandfather, he said, yes, you boys got a good thought, but you can't go until you go and ask your grandmother. If she says all right, then you can go. So they went down to the river where the grandmother was fixing her acorns and cleaning it, and they told her what they wanted to do. She said, you boys got a good thought. You might be able to handle or help one or two. So she made them small in their namesake. And she rolled them up in her fanning basket. A fanning basket's about that big, round, and it's shaped like a saucer. And when you roll it up, it looks like a cigar. And she rolled them up and put them inside there and towed them across the water. When they landed, they became their own natural size, and they looked. They looked at the people, and then they looked at themselves. And they said, we can't show up like this. We won't be able to open our mouth. They'll kill us before we can open our mouth. So they made themselves little again. And then they watched. And this little spider said, this girl comes down here every morning and drinks water here this spring. I'm going to jump in her cup, and I'll be born from her, he said. The little lizard said, those two old people never had any children. I'm going to be born from her, he said. So that's how they got there. The little spider was killed, and he was brought back over here. The little lizard was killed, and he's still over there. So if you go up in the high mountains now, you'll find cocoons, big silver cocoons, about that long. And if you open them up, you'll see a little man laying in there. He's got his hair braided down his side here. Got little eyes, nose, and mouth. And his hands are folded across his chest. He said, and you see that, then you'll know where he's at. He is still sleeping. And when he wakes up, that's when the destruction will start.
That was the story of the lizard and the spider, told by Mr. Willard Rhodes, recorded at a summer camp on the land of the hereditary chief of the Ajumawi, another band of the Pitt River Indians. It has become very rare that these stories are told to strangers like me, but Mr. Rhodes made it very clear that he wants them to be told and passed on. The way I understand it is that he believes that in spite of the great danger to the planet, we do have a choice in the outcome. Maybe Willard Rhodes gave away the gift of his story to remind us of the option and opportunity. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Drastic consequences to life as we know it here on Mother Earth are the topics of this, the first of a two-part series on abrupt climate change. Once again, we visit with Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources, Ecology, and Evolutionary Biology from the University of Arizona. McPherson discusses how global warming is affecting climate change. He explains the physics of what will occur when the polar ice cap has melted, ending its ability to reflect the heat of the sun. Instead, the heat of the sun will be absorbed by the world's oceans. McPherson predicts that could well occur by 2022 or sooner, causing the temperature of the oceans to increase. He argues that this temperature rise will result in the loss of the planetary air conditioner and the loss of habitat for human species. Additional information about the status of abrupt climate change may be found on the Radio Curious website. That's radiocurious.org. Guy McPherson and I visited by phone on August 12, 2018, when he was on a speaking tour traveling in the United States. We began our conversation when I asked him to describe the current state of climate change now in 2018.
I think we're going to continue to see more of what we're already seeing in the months, the few months remaining of 2018. I think the fires in California, for example, are beyond the point of human control. Only the weather is going to put out those fires, and the floods will continue throughout many parts of the world. So we have a world characterized by fire and floods of biblical proportions. I don't see that going away anytime soon. In fact, this could very well be the year that we lose ice in the Arctic Ocean, an event that was projected to occur in 2016, plus or minus 3 years, by a paper that appeared in 2012 in the Annual Review of Earth and Planetary Sciences. So it could be that we have that happen this year, according to a paper that came out of the United States Navy just a couple of days ago. More than 99% of the ice in the Arctic Ocean is less than a meter thick. So to say we're treading on thin ice would be quite the understatement at this point. So we truly are facing dire times. And if we manage to dodge the bullet again this year, and it could very well happen that we have a little bit of ice left at the end of the melt season, say the autumnal equinox in North America, then I can't imagine we make it through another year with ice in the Arctic Ocean. So, the planet is heating very abruptly. We are about 1 3/4 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline. And I think it's only going to get worse. I think habitat for humans is going to continue to disappear at a rapid clip, as we are already seeing.
In terms of the comparison of the 1750 habitat baseline, could you please review that for our listeners?
Yes. The Earth came out of the last ice age some 12,000 or so years ago, and the temperature increased about 1.5 degrees Celsius. Ice age is a global average temperature of about 12 degrees Celsius or 54 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the global average temperature when we're in the midst of an ice age. Earth came out of that ice age and warmed, and for the first time in the last 2 billion years, stabilized at a fairly cool temperature of 13.5 degrees Celsius, just 1.5 degrees Celsius above that ice age. So that is approximately 3 degrees Fahrenheit above ice age, or somewhere in the neighborhood of about 57 degrees Fahrenheit. It doesn't sound like much, but it's that relatively mild increase in global average temperature. And then very importantly, the stabilization of that temperature for a few thousand years that allowed for the first time ever for civilizations to arise. So we hit a relatively cool temperature. The Earth stabilized at that cool temperature. And suddenly, all around the world, civilizations popped up because humans were able to grow grains at a relatively large scale. Up until that point, that had never happened. And so humans had never been particularly adept at storing food for an extended period of time.
Let's stay, if we may, with those temperatures. When they stabilized at 57 degrees Fahrenheit, when was that?
That was about 7,000 or so years ago. You know, the temperature records are not that great going back to then, so we don't know for sure, but it appears to have stabilized coming out of that last ice age somewhere around 10,000 to 7,000 years ago, and that coincided with the arisal, the creation, the formation of several civilizations popping up all over the planet, at least half a dozen of them at various places around the globe.
That would indicate that there were already humans like us living there.
Absolutely.
They were just expanding because they could grow the food more easily.
Absolutely. And so, you know, our species, Homo sapiens, has been around for about 300,000 years. And so for the first 290,000 years or so, no civilizations ever appeared. The ability to grow grains at a pretty large scale and therefore allow people to get through the tough winters or the tough summers or the periods when crops failed just was absent. So it was a hunter-gatherer society until 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, at which point the global average temperature reached a point and then stabilized at that point. So we have relatively stable temperatures. And so people in societies, in groups, in communities, are paradoxically, for the first time, apparently, in the history of our species, are able to grow and distribute grain at a relatively large scale. That's what characterizes every civilization, including the current one, is the ability to grow, store, and distribute grains at scale.
So continuing our description towards the 1750 baseline at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
We're there. That's where that 1750 baseline is at 13.5 degrees, about 1.5 degrees Celsius above Ice Age. That 13.5 degrees Celsius is the baseline that cool, stable temperature that persisted coming out of the last ice age until 1750 is the benchmark that we use to compare today's temperature to.
And the importance of that?
Is the ability to grow grains and store them and distribute them at scale. That's what characterizes this set of living arrangements and all of the civilizations, is that cool but stable temperature. And so once we're there, and we spent quite a long time there, the first 250 years or so of the Industrial Revolution, and then temperature began to creep up, and more recently it shot up to a temperature that's about 1.75 degrees Celsius above that 1750 baseline. So we're fast approaching the maximum temperature that has housed our species on the planet, which is about 2 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline, according to a legal brief filed by James Hansen in 2015. So we're almost there. We're almost beyond the temperature at which humans have occupied planet Earth in the past, at least with respect to Homo sapiens, our species.
So when that manifests on the material plane, our Earth, what will happen to our species?
Well, I strongly suspect that it's at that 2 degrees C, at or near there, that we lose habitat for our species around the globe. We've never had our species at a temperature above approximately 2 degrees Celsius, above the 1750 baseline, or 15.5 degrees Celsius. And I suspect that's because there's no habitat for humans at that point. If there is, there won't be for much longer. We keep increasing global average temperature, and that produces the chaos that we're seeing today. Hurricanes and fire NATOs and shifting of the continental plates as a result of melting of glaciers, and on the list goes. And I don't think we need to wait much longer to see a profound, unprecedented event that almost certainly will remove habitat for our species throughout the entire planet, and that's the loss of ice in the Arctic Ocean. When that happens, according even to the president of Finland, we lose the Arctic ice, we lose habitat for humans all around the planet. And we're on the verge. That could happen this year. I'm at the point where I don't think it'll happen this year, but it could. And, you know, that's an event projected by a paper in the Referee Journal Literature to occur in 2016, plus or minus 3 years, paper published in 2012. So we'll see.
And what we're saying is sea level rise.
Not much sea level rise, because the Arctic ice is floating ice. It's on top of the seawater. But instead, what we'll see is the loss of the planetary air conditioner. Imagine that the planet, like many houses in Southern California today, only allows humans to persist because there's an air conditioner running in the house. And in our case, that air conditioner is the Arctic ice. We lose the Arctic ice, suddenly the water heats up very, very quickly in the Arctic Ocean. The Washington Post ran a story a couple of weeks ago comparing the Arctic Ocean today with the Atlantic Ocean, because the Atlantic Ocean and the Arctic Ocean are becoming indiscernible at the interface between them. We lose the albedo, or the reflectance from the ice that's in the Arctic, when we lose the ice in the Arctic. And so that's going to cause the Arctic, and therefore the planet, to heat up even faster. Already, the Arctic is heating up many times faster than the global average. But what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It spreads rapidly to the rest of the globe. As if that's not bad enough, once we lose the ice, I don't see how we keep a cap on the billions of tons of methane clathrates that are found in the relatively shallow seafloor of the Arctic Ocean. And once we start releasing those clathrates, or the methane within those clathrates, the planet will heat up very, very rapidly in a short period of time.
We are visiting with Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson, a Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources, Ecology, and Evolutionary Biology from the University of Arizona. And there are several interviews that you can hear with him on Radio Curious that we did 3 years ago at radiocurious.org. This is, as I say, Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Guy, the methane release, that seems to be critical, and you've talked about it in the past. Can you refresh that for our listeners?
Yes. Natalia Shakova is one of the premier authorities on Arctic ice. She and her research team, including Igor Samelatov, her research partner and life partner, have conducted many expeditions in the Arctic Ocean. In 2008, reported that we could expect an abrupt release of methane hydrates, up to a 50 gigaton burst of methane hydrates. They said that could occur at any time. It's likely for abrupt release at any time. Well, that's been nearly 10 years ago. I'm a little surprised it hasn't happened yet. For confirmation of that paper, Shakova and colleagues had a paper published in Nature Communications in 2017, and an entirely different research team comprised of a dozen different authors from the paper with Shakova et al. Was published also that same year, 2017, I believe in the summer, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Both of those papers pointed out that such events had occurred in Earth's history before humans were present, and therefore was likely to occur at pretty much any time going into the future. So it's now known, according to even the very conservative Referee Journal literature, that abrupt releases of large quantities of methane can be released from beneath the relatively shallow seafloor of the Arctic Ocean, and that will heat the planet
very, very rapidly. Methane is more than 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, molecule for molecule. So when we're talking about gigatons of release, that's something to be taken very, very seriously. That's an enormous existential risk.
Professor Guy McPherson, can you give us some more details on what will set off the abrupt release of methane and what will happen if that occurs?
Yes, those hydrates or clathrates, those chemical cages that hold the methane in place in the relatively shallow seafloor of the Arctic Ocean, those chemical cages fall apart with as little as a 1 degree Celsius temperature increase. Well, that water in the Arctic Ocean is warming up quite rapidly, as indicated even by papers in the Washington Post. And when a large number of clathrates lying there in the shallow seabed warms up just a little bit more, I think we can expect that very abrupt release of methane hydrate to occur, essentially coincident with that event. So that's why the president of Finland is going around the planet during approximately the last year and telling people that if we lose the Arctic ice, we lose habitat for humans very shortly thereafter. Not that same day, obviously, not even that same week, but very quickly thereafter, when the methane is fully circulated in the atmosphere of the planet, the Earth is going to heat up quite rapidly beyond the point at which humans have appeared on this planet in the past. And that will remove habitat for all of those species that we depend upon for our own existence.
When you say quite rapidly, how fast is that?
Well, locally, methane increases the temperature in a matter of days, regionally in a matter of weeks, globally within a year. The circulation in the atmosphere of methane and other gases occurs relatively rapidly. So once you have that release of methane or any other greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, it takes a year or less for complete circulation around the globe. So the air that you breathe out today, those molecules will be breathed in by other people on the planet, all over the planet, within a year. So this indicates the interconnected nature of you and me and every other organism on the planet that depends upon respiration for its survival. That means all of us.
What will happen? What will it feel like to Homo sapiens when that occurs?
I suspect we're going to see a significant uptick in death as a result of lethal wet bulb temperatures in places like India and the tropical and subtropical regions that are already becoming uncomfortably warm. Lethal wet bulb temperatures manifest when the global average, or when the local temperature is 95 degrees Fahrenheit and the relative humidity is near or at 100%. And any increase in temperature of a degree or two associated with a decline in relative humidity also is lethal. And what this means is that we cannot dump heat fast enough. We're physiologically incapable as homeothermic organisms, as warm-blooded creatures, of dumping heat fast enough to survive. And so we experience organ failure. I think that's one of the things we're going to see occurring far more abundantly than we're seeing today. Also, if people are able to connect the dots, I think we're already seeing global warming-related deaths. A friend of mine is a medical doctor in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. She is from Germany, and her father was recently put into a hospital in Germany. And there, of course, are no air conditioners at the hospitals in Germany or almost any other public building because we've never needed them. It's never been hot enough for long enough to justify air conditioners in that part of the world. And her father died within a couple of days later because his body wasn't able to dump the heat fast enough, and there wasn't the capacity in the building to cool it down. So nobody in the media, nobody in the government, nobody in the hospital is going to say that he died as a result of global warming. But I don't see how we can deny that being a contributor to his death. And we're seeing that all over the planet now. These slight increases in temperature that overwhelm the existing infrastructure, including evaporative cooling and air conditioning and water delivery and every other aspect of life that we have come to depend upon, is being compromised right now by increased global average temperatures that are manifest at the local level in temperatures that are setting records. Again, I refer to the Washington Post, not exactly now that it's been taken over by the founder of Amazon, Bezos, not exactly a liberal left-wing publication. And they've been reporting regularly on the extremely high number of temperature records that are being smashed all around the world. That's not going to go away, not anytime soon. In addition, we're headed into an El Nino event. We're coming out of the La Nina we've been in for a while that has contributed to the major hurricane season in the Atlantic Ocean. That's going to switch back to the Pacific. We're entering the third El Nino Southern Oscillation in 4 years. It used to be 7 or 10 years between those occurrences, and now we're looking at the third one in 4 years. When that El Nino gets its grip, as it almost certainly will within the next month or two, then the planet is going to heat up even faster, because that's one of the characteristics of an El Nino Southern Oscillation, is an enormous amount of heat comes out of the oceans, most notably the Pacific Ocean, and spills out onto land. And so it's very possible that we will have a global average temperature 2 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline by the end of this year as a result of us slipping into this El Nino Southern Oscillation.
Going back to the inability to cool a human body or the body of any other creature that breathes air, being immersed in water, cool water, does not help.
That will help. That's the thing to do. Either take a cold shower or get yourself in a pool, because that's the only way your body's going to be able to dump heat fast enough. Just standing in front of a fan will not do it. You're still going to die from organ failure if the temperature and humidity are collectively too high. The only escape is the ability to get into a cool tub of water or into a lake or into a shower. But you know, we're shutting down nuclear power plants all over the planet because the rivers and the oceans are too hot to cool them. And that's a metaphor for what's going on with human civilization as well as for human life. At some point, it just gets too warm. The body of water doesn't cool the body of the human enough to make a difference. So that's clearly where we're headed. And the symptoms, the incidents are already underway for people who are willing to pay attention and connect a few dots.
The organs that shut down, which are they and what is the sequence?
They're primarily organs that, as I understand it, organs that are in the central core of the body, you know, around the heart and the lungs, the kidneys, the liver, that these are the organs that depend upon cooling systems in your body to maintain their proper function.
Professor Guy McPherson, tell us about the symptoms of which we should be aware when the body does not cool down rapidly enough.
Some of the symptoms of lethal wet bulb temperatures and organ failure associated with those lethal wet bulb temperatures include things like lack of judgment. So people actually act like they're drunk. So if you're out there hammering nails with somebody or working in a garden with somebody, and suddenly they start doing things that are out of character for them. So they lose their balance, for example, or they start
acting in ways that you would expect if they were inebriated, but they're not inebriated. It's 11 o'clock in the morning. You've been working side by side and they've been sweating a lot and you've been talking about the heat, but suddenly they can't stand up properly or they can't seem to grasp the weeds they're attempting to pull out of the ground. These are the kinds of symptoms that are manifest when people are experiencing organ failure associated with lethal wet bulb temperatures. You see people actually act like they're drunk. And, you know, we expect that when we're at a party with somebody and they start acting a little goofy. But if they're doing it when it's noon or 1 o'clock or whatever, and you're hammering nails or working on a construction project or working in the garden, and it's that kind of physical activity, that's an early warning sign that something is going seriously wrong and you better take action right away.
Beyond lethal wet bulb temperatures and organ failures, what else might we encounter that would be a cause of death as a result of global temperature rise?
The global average temperature rise will compromise grain production and storage and distribution, and that will have knock-on effects. Lethal wet bulb temperatures are directly attributable to increased temperature rise and increased humidity. So that's a no-brainer. People living near the ocean and tropical and subtropical areas, when they start experiencing those symptoms, you can just point right at it and say, well, yes, obviously the planet is heating up. That means it's heating up right here and wherever you happen to live. And so these are the kinds of symptoms and occurrences that one would expect. But there's something that is rarely talked about, and that is the failure of the grain crops as a result of the global average temperature going beyond that cool, stable temperature that allows us to grow, store, and distribute grains. What that means is the set of living arrangements to which we affectionately refer as civilization could break down. And then there will be abundant starvation because we've come to depend upon the food on the shelves of the grocery store so heavily, almost all of it.
Guy McPherson is a professor emeritus of natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology from the University of Arizona. In the next edition of Radio Curious, we will further discuss this wretched and apparently irreversible state of the world. You may hear previous interviews with McPherson at radiocurious.org. This program was recorded on August 12, 2018. There are over 500 editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free to listen, download, and share as you wish. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel.